Ladies and gentlemen, recorded in Fredericton, New Brunswick, Canada, it's time for Fight Night Picks with your host, Frank
and Matt
Allen.
And we're back and we're getting ready for UFC Fight Night Hall versus Strickland. As always, one half of your hosting duo away from the house, back out on the road, but really looking forward to this card. Craig Allen, you can find me on Twitter and Instagram at Craig Allen FNP. With me to my virtual left, to your virtual right, we have Matt Allen. As always, you can find him at Matt Allen FNP on the respective socials. Matt, last weekend, little bit of a crapshoot as far as the picks were concerned. The judging was horrific. And of course, a lot of people were very upset in the comments sections. And Matt, to add insult to injury, we got called out by Billy Quarantillo over on the Instagrams. The Allen boys, we just can't pick up a win. But I am really looking forward to this card. And Matt, I have to say, a lot of the comments out there this week are, who are some of these fighters? We've never heard of them before. What are we going to get for a co-main event? And while I can tell you about all of these fighters, what they graduated in from university or college, what they decided to study after the fact, where they work, where they train. Matt, to really answer the question, we've had three or four different co-main events so far and they've all fallen out.
This isn't a great card, Craig. Let's just call it what it is. Like, the main event's not terrible. Like, Uriah Hall, Sean Strickland should be a good fight. Uriah Hall has, again, he's not one of the most popular fighters in the UFC by any means, but, you know, he is a bit of a fan base, and Sean Strickland seems to be on the come up. He hasn't lost since that crazy knockout to Eliezer Zaleski dos Santos, so I do understand that main event, but after that main event, it does fall off a little bit. Like, I'm not trying to sound like Jeff Wagenheim here, but normally the co-main event is better than Gloria De Paula versus Cheyenne Bays. Like, Cheyenne Bays got mopped by Montserrat Ruiz in her last fight, and Montserrat got absolutely destroyed by Amanda Lemos. It's just, the talent isn't really there on this card. There's going to be some great fights, and listen, this is one of those cards where when you always don't think it's going to meet your expectations, it always does. It's just, this card doesn't really have the star-studded lineup that some of the last Fight Night ones have.
Well, let's talk about it, because when we look through this card in terms of co-main events, originally you were supposed to have Shamil Abdurakhimov, Chris Daukaus. That was moved from last week's card to this week. And then something about Shamil Abdurakhimov felt weak. That was the tweet that Chris Daukaus threw out there. So unfortunate that that fight we do not get. You were also supposed to have what? It was Munir Lazez, Nicholas Stutz. Now, Stutz threw it out there on his Instagram. He said, for my English-speaking fans, and then basically said that Lazez was out. Looks like there's some visa issues there. We don't get that fight, but you're right. I mean, right now, if you look at the card, Gloria De Paula, who's had one fight in the UFC and it was a lopsided loss, is going to be taking on Cheyenne Bays, who equally had his lopsided a loss. And you go down through the card. Jinyu Frey was supposed to take on Iztela Nunes. That one falls out. You had Duho Choi supposed to be taking on Danny Chavez. Choi is out. Juan Camilo Ronderos is out. My guy, Askar Askarov, out of his fight with Alex Perez. Then you have Ronnie Lawrence, who's supposed to take on John Castaneda. Castaneda's out. Roman Kopilov couldn't make it to the States from Russia. So Sam Alvey doesn't get a fight, which he announced on TikTok. Pretty strange.
Weird.
Sam Alvey, 0-4-1 in his last five, and there's an extra loss tacked onto that, so it's not sexy. But overall, it is a card that's lost plenty of fights. However, what we're going to do this week, Matt, we're going to be happy. We're going to be positive. Last week was terrible, so what we're going to do, we're going to throw it on over to our Fight of the Night screen, which is, as always, presented by Manscaped, and we're going to tell you about four fighters that you have to watch coming up this weekend. We're looking for fights to tell you about, and I can't wait for this one. This is a possible fight of the night. We have Trevin Jones, five-star Trevin Jones, taking on Ronnie Lawrence. And you look at it for both these guys, shuffled and moved around in different fights. Ronnie Lawrence originally supposed to be taking on John Castaneda on this card. Trevin Jones, he was supposed to take on a couple of different guys, Tony Kelly, and then I had done up the graphics. He was supposed to take on Aaron Phillips a week or two ago. That falls out. These guys ultimately meet each other. For Trevin Jones, it's not a slight at Ronnie Lawrence, who's really young in his career, but for Trevin Jones, it feels like he should be fighting higher levels of competition just based on the win over Valiev. And his last time out, he was a big underdog. He opened a pay-per-view and he fought Mario Bautista. You're in my guy. And he finished him in emphatic fashion. Ronnie Lawrence, for him, in his debut, beating Vince Cachero the way he did, he absolutely dominated that fight. So I can't wait for this one. What are you thinking?
This is one of those fights that you just kind of expect it not to go to its scorecard. Like, it's going to be a finish one way or another, because Ronnie Lawrence throws absolute haymakers when he walks forward. And for Trevin Jones, like, he's kind of been counted out each and every fight. And listen, with good reason, like, Valiev's a very, very good fighter. And Mario Bautista is not bad either. But Trevin Jones just keeps on looking better and better and better. And it does start to bring up the question of, where is Trevin Jones' ceiling? And this is one of those great fights, because you could honestly bring up the same question for Ronnie Lawrence. Like, both these guys could have top 15 futures, and that's why this fight's gonna be so much fun.
Well, I can't wait for that. And then our second pick for a possible fight of the night, we have two debuting fighters. It's not often that we go this way, but we're taking a hard turn here. We have Colin Anglin, who's going to be taking on Melsik Bogdasarian, the gun. He represents Glendale Fighting Club, as well as the, what is it, Muay Thai America gym. I've seen him training in California, getting ready for this one. Only 5-1, but his four wins before Dana White's Contender Series, all of them quick finishes, sub-minute finishes. For Colin Anglin, a little bit of a wrestling background in his back pocket, so it is a clash of styles, but this one's definitely going to deliver if you've seen either one of these guys fight.
This should be a really fun fight. Like, I went back and watched a bunch of Melsik's kickboxing fights, and, like, he can throw hands. His striking's really nice, and he's a really tricky southpaw, throws, like, a nice right hook, kind of like Poirier. Like, he's much more kick-heavy offense, but there's a lot to like there, too. And from Colin Anglin, it's going to be really interesting to see how he approaches this fight, because he has been able to really mix in his striking with his wrestling up until this point. But is this really the fight that you want to be messing around on the feet with a guy like Melsik? I don't believe so, but I really do think this fight's gonna be really, really fun.
Can't wait for it. And as always, your fight of the night screen, it is presented by Manscaped. And Matt, listen, we got to do this. How about this?
Oh, Craig in the wild, he's like Bigfoot. Are we gonna see him again? Oh,
I think what did I say? Him. When you're traveling and you're not home, you got to bring the Shed travel bag, all the great Manscaped products with me in the wild. I've got the Crop Reviver, used it this morning. Great stuff there. So check them out. Manscaped.com. Use promo code FNP. You're going to get 20% off and free shipping. Check them out. You support them. You support us. It's a great partnership. Matt, I can't wait for this fight card. So we went from 15 total fights down to 12, but they should deliver. And there's a lot of names that aren't, well, household names. So what we're going to do, Matt, we're going to clip in a lot of our introductory video, so you get a good idea and understanding of the background of each one of these fighters. I'll make sure to add some of those timestamps and helpful hints so you can get to know some of these guys and gals before the weekend. But like I said, can't wait for it. We had some weird hipster picks for fight of the night, and it should be a card that absolutely delivers. And if you've got any time left over, because there are fights just dropping like flies at this point, maybe check out our second channel. It's 15-minute card breaks. It's down below in that description. We're breaking the wax. We're opening the packs, and we've got some great finds over there. So check it out. 15-minute card breaks. It's quick. It's easy. Support the channel. We've already got over 100 subscribers, and we definitely want to thank you for that. And make sure you tune in for Question Mark Kicks. That's always live on the Saturday of fight day. 2 hours before the prelims, we get a chance to talk about the recap in terms of the weigh-ins and make our final picks and predictions. So I can't wait for that, Matt. We got a neat card coming up. And as we always say with fight night picks,
let's get into it.
To us, it might be all too familiar, but to you, it could be like listening to Blinded by the Light by Bruce Springsteen, only to go, wait now, isn't this a Manfred Mann Earth Band song? And then you only get to find out that the boss did it first, because Matt, I'm taking on a mental pretzel in this one. This was a fight that was booked May the 8th, and Ryan Benoit weighed in at 129 pounds for the second time in his career when he's supposed to fight at 125. So he weighs 4 pounds over championship weight, 3 pounds over the divisional weight limit, and he looked like absolute death. Now, the last time that we saw somebody weigh in, and it was this scary, it was my gal, Lithuania's own, Yulia Stoyarenko, and it didn't work out for her in her fight against Julia Avila. But overall, if you look at it for Ryan Benoit, again, it really is tricky in terms of the weigh-ins. I mean, we've seen him fight at 135 pounds in the UFC, took on Alatang Haili in a really close competitive fight over in China. But getting ready for this one again, the last time he weighed 129 pounds was against one of the Mokhtarian brothers. That was back in November of 2017. Originally, this fight wasn't supposed to happen on this date. Again, they booked it in May, it fell out, but it was supposed to be Juan Camilo Ronderos. who was supposed to be taking on Zaruk Adashev. Now all of a sudden he draws Ryan Benoit again at 125 pounds. So Matt, in terms of this video, well, we've already done it. So what we're going to do, we're going to clip that original prediction video in. Most of it still stands. And then at the end, we're going to update you with our final thoughts and the odds for this one. Ryan Benoit, he's taking on a really high level of competition. You might not like the record. It's 10-7. But if I go down through here, let's just pick some of these out. Anthony Berchek, that was an early one. He also took on Josh Sampo, Canadian. Sergio Pettis, Ben Wynn. Freddie Serrano, okay, well, Brandon, that's Moreno. Fine. Brandon Moreno, Ashkan Mokhtarian, then he took a long time off, fought Alatang Haley, and that was one, that was a really close fight. I know Matt, at the time, like, going back, thought that close. Alatang Haley won, but still, it was close. And then he fought Tim Elliott his last time out. That one was back in July. Fairly competitive fight, if you go back and look at it. They each threatened with submissions. They were able to get takedowns. They were able to strike. It was a close one. 29-28 across the board. That's fair. Second round, probably the closest of the three. But a competitive fight against a guy who's also been there and done that. Now you're taking on Zaruk Adashev. And Matt, we had this conversation last week, and I saw a lot of people out there in the comments section. Randa Markos is terrible. She's 10-10-1. All right, slow your roll. Hey, there was a knockout in that fight, kind of, and pretty unfortunate. But Zaruk Adashev is a special kind of 500 because he's 3-3, and you look at it, he lost his debut against Cody Mooney back in 2015. Then he took over 3 years off from MMA. This guy's a kickboxer. He has a 16-3 kickboxing record. He competed with Glory. He's fought some decent names. You go back, like, he's a really flashy striker. And when I hand it over to you, that's kind of the big point you have to hammer home with Zaruk Adashev. But again, level competition. Cody Mooney was 1-1. Christian Medina, 0-1. Ron Leon, 0-2. That was Bellator 215. In 2019, this guy was fighting 0-2 fighters. He fought Tevin Dice. First round was competitive in that fight. Tevin Dice, all right fighter at 3-1. Second round, finished him. And that's when Zaruk started to gain his confidence. Then he comes in and replaces Ryan Benoit and fights Tyson Nam back last year. And gets starched early.
He did get... Oh.
And he missed weight.
Exactly. So this is my problem for Adashev. Right now at 3-3, he is at this weird point in his career. And I'm going to compare him to Joe Rogan's favorite kickboxer, Alex Pereira, because he's kind of also in this same category where I'm pretty sure Pereira's kick or his MMA record, he's like 2-1. As an MMA fighter, he's very inexperienced.
Now he's coming up. He's coming up with LFA, Alex Pereira.
Hear me out, though. But in MMA, he's fighting guys who are like 1-1. Guys who should not be in the cage with him because his level of experience is way higher than what it really is. And really, he's going to hurt most guys who are at his level of experience in pure MMA just because he is so good outside of it. Trust me, look up this guy's kickboxing highlights. He is very good. He's not just hype from Joe Rogan. But with Adashev, here's the weird thing. We talk about the flashiness of his striking. He has very fast spinning back kicks, very fast spinning back fists. He's a guy who's not afraid to use his spinning techniques either. He's a guy who can span them sometimes, kind of like Merab Dvalishvili. I know you've been kind of critical on his spinning back fist, but he's a guy who kind of overuses the technique. And I know I've talked about this before with Adashev, but I'm going to keep on bringing it up. I'm going to feed this horse until it dies. I don't know if it's the big gloves that they use in kickboxing. I don't know if it's him worried about the takedown. There's just something different between him in kickboxing and him in MMA. And I haven't been able to put my finger on it because he's so susceptible to getting hit to guys who, yes, they're high-level strikers. Like, losing to Tyson Nam by knockout is not the end of the world. And losing to a guy like Sue Muttergee, who is a very high-level striker, is not the end of the world. But when you look at Adashev's level of competition, and when you just look at really what you think his striking or what level it should be at, he hasn't shown that in the UFC up to this point, even in the Sue Muttergee fight. Like, Muttergee's a guy who can get hit quite a bit, but offensively, he's a really tough fighter to deal with. Muttergee just walked forward on him and really didn't have that much respect for the counter-striking of Adashev. With Adashev, I really do think it's one of those cases of when you're moving forward on him, he can strike and he can put things together, but his success really comes from moving forward. And when he's the one who can figure out the range in the fight, that's when he's going to have the most success. It's interesting, though, because if he's the one moving forward on a guy like Ryan Benoit, Ryan Benoit's one of the few knockout artists in this division who, if he does catch you with a big shot on the feet, he's going to put you down.
With Sumat Erji, the thing, too, if you go back, you look at the second round against Zaruk Adashev, Zaruk started to get some confidence, and then the third round, it was just, oh, okay, Sumat Erji's just going to pour it on again. So for Adashev, it's really tough. I mean, he's one of those guys, and we talked about it. You know, recently, you've got Carl Robertson, and he's such a good striker. He's a Glory kickboxer. He's so accredited. He also trains with one of the best light heavyweights in the world, and I'm not afraid to say it anymore. Beast and 25-8 Corey Anderson. And the combination of those two guys, you've got the wrestling from Anderson, you've got the striking from Robertson. Put those two guys together, that could be the best fighter on the face of the planet. If you add the combination of those two, best fighter ever. Beat John Jones. Mark my words. You look at Saruk Adashev, he trains at a Nick Cantone MMA. What are they known for? Wrestlers. And you look at it, I mean, Claudia Gadelha, when she went there, had a little bit more success. Frankie Edgar trains there. Lance Palmer's trains there. So on. And Lance Palmer, yikes, against Bubba Jenkins. But you get my point.
A lot of people have lost recently.
But a lot of wrestlers. So for Saruk Adashev, it could be, am I so afraid of the takedown that I can't open up with my hands? Is it a totally different striking method than just kickboxing with the gloves up there? Because we have seen kickboxers get outstruck recently in MMA by non-strikers. Like, Brennan Allen put on a striking clinic against the man himself, Carl Robertson, not that long ago. It's odd to see. And in a fight like this, you have a fighter, again, Ryan Benoit doesn't have the sexiest record. It's 10-7. But again, if I pick out the losses, Tim Elliott, Alatang Haley, good fighter at 135. Brandon Moreno by split decision. Ben 10 win. Josh Sampo, yikes, but again, that was 2013, and Benoit's had these long layoffs, but training out of Team Oyama for a fight like this, which is where Benoit's coming from, I mean, I would be worried if I'm Saruk Adashev at the threat of the takedown, too.
Oh, 100%. Ryan Benoit, and I'm going to say it again, I used this comparison once last week to describe a fighter at light heavyweight. Ryan Benoit is your Mike Perry at 125. He has big power in his hands, he has good offensive wrestling, but he struggles against guys who can kind of smother him or guys who are really technical on the feet. But if you're not any of those things, Ryan Benoit, he's got crazy big power for the size of him. And I don't mean that as like a disrespectful way. He just does have big power for the size of him. He's got head kicks. He's got overhands. Like, he's one of the few power threats at that division not named Deiveson Figueiredo. So when you are in there with Ryan Benoit, you not only have to worry about being taken down, which is something that Adashev just kind of built into his whole game going into MMA. He's always worried about getting taken down. But if you are leaving your hands down, if you are not giving Ryan Benoit the respect he deserves on the feet, he's going to tune you up and hit you with some good shots. I'm not going to say that Ryan Benoit's going to go out there, crack Adashev with one shot and knock him out the first round, but he is one of those guys who, if you're not watching your P's and Q's and you pull out of an exchange with your chin up and your hands down, he can crack you and put you down. So for Ryan Benoit, this is a great fight to get him back on track. He's one of those guys who I do think his record is a little bit deceiving. His skills are a lot better than that 10-7 record show. And even, look, if you lose a split decision to Haile Alatang, it's not the end of the world, but it's rare that you go from losing to a guy to Alatang and then you go up to fight Tim Elliott, who's quite a bit ahead of Alatang in the rankings. But it's not like Ryan Benoit got a lot worse between those fights. He's still just kind of the same fighter every single time in and every single time out. So for Benoit, I don't think we're going to see any massive improvements in his game. I still think we're going to see the same guy. He's going to go for a few takedowns. He's got decent top control. If he gets ground and pound off, that's great. And if he hits you on the feet, that's great too. So I think Benoit's going to be able to get this one done, but I think my prediction for Benoit's more based off the fact that I haven't been impressed with Saruk Adashev's UFC career at all up until this point.
That one round against Sumedergi, if you saw that, you combine that with some highlight reel footage over on YouTube, maybe you're a big Saruk Adashev fan, maybe you like that Nick Cantone MMA connection with the defensive hips, but you look at it again, Benoit with the fight against Alatang Haley, that one was at bantamweight, then he dropped back down to flyweight, got Tim Elliott, who was kind of hitting the skids, and that fight was relatively close. I know it was a decision loss, it was unanimous, and the one against Alatang Haley was a split, but still, relatively close. So overall, in terms of the odds, you look at it, Ryan Benoit actually shaved off a few points. He was originally about a minus 150 going into their first meeting. He opened for this fight at a minus 140. He's now somewhere around a minus 136. If you look at it for Saruk Adashev, open a plus 120. He's now at a plus 113. If we head on over to Tapology, it's a surprise to us as it is to you. 896 total votes, 81% for Benoit, 75% by decision for the 19% that have Adashev, 66% by decision. So Matt, final thoughts on this one. Who are you going with and what are you thinking here?
Okay, two things we know have to be true. I think Ryan Benoit is definitely better than he really is. I think we can both agree to that much. And Saruk Adashev, they're going to talk about his glory kickboxing experience. It is the definition of wolf tickets. Whatever the commentary tells you about him and his kickboxing background, it's great, don't get me wrong. But when I've seen you get like outstruck convincingly in two straight fights. I don't really care about your glory background. It doesn't mean that much to me anymore. So I guess this is the last point I have about Ryan Benoit and his weight missing. Right now, I have to assume that he can make flyweight. Now, it's very similar to Sajara Eubanks last weekend, where Sajara Eubanks, she had missed weight. We didn't really know if she was going to make weight at 125, but going into fight week and leading up to weigh-ins, I have to assume that Ryan Benoit will be able to make the weight. Now, if he doesn't make his weight, isn't that the beautiful thing, Craig? We just happen to have a show called Question Mark Kicks that allows us to go back and, you know, revise or edit any picks that we made earlier on in the week. So right now, I do have to stick with my pick of Ryan Benoit. He does have big power for this weight division if he is able to make 125. And I do have to believe that at some point he's going to be able to mix in his wrestling with his power shots and probably get a decision win.
That's it. I mean, if you look at Ryan Benoit and you look at some of the other guys that Zaruk Adashev's taken on in the past, I mean, Tyson Nam said no mas, or well, I guess it was Zaruk Adashev saying no mas, because that fight was over so quickly. And then his next fight against Sumit Erji, yeah, he had a little bit more success. He had a little bit more time to work, but overall, it was Sumit Erji looking very good in that fight. So for me, I have a hard time going with a guy that's 3-3 in the UFC and really hasn't shown us what he's all about. Again, if you want to go back and see a good fight, it's the one against Tevin Dice over with Bellator, but Tevin Dice is no Ryan Benoit. So with you, I'm in agreement, both of us going with Ryan Benoit to get the win. I can't wait for our main event. Sean Strickland, he is streaking. Is he going streaking in the quad? I don't know, but he is streaking. He's going to be taking on Uriah Hall. That is one tough fight. You're not going to want to miss that video. And the rest of them, keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks. And as we always say,
let's get into it.
This is the return in the debut of Orion Cosi. Matt, I can't wait for this fight. He's going to be making his first appearance since last August. He had a win over Matt Dixon on Dana White's Contender Series. Both of these guys competing on this card and in this fight competed on Dana White's Contender Series. Matt, for Orion Cosi, he was originally supposed to be coming into the UFC against Nicholas Dalby at UFC 255. Unfortunately, there was a little bit of an injury. And you know what? Luckily for Fight Night Picks fans, our own JHK MMA spoke with Orion Cosi. We're going to get his insight into his injury and a little bit of his recovery. So let's throw it on over to JHK.
Yeah, so you talk about the injury and you had to have surgery and then you come back. Did it make you realize a lot of things that you were doing wrong in like your training? You know, I don't want to say wrong, but like some things that maybe you're overtraining possibly.
Yeah, so I mean, overtraining is a sign that you're doing something wrong though. A lot of people don't realize that. When you overtrain, you're actually making it to where your body doesn't recover properly. You're getting more injury prone. And that's all that happened. I was so excited to fight, you know, Nick Dalby because he's a vet in the sport. He was in the UFC before. He was making his comeback to the UFC. I was super stoked. I was on my honeymoon when I found out I had that fight. And I was like, fuck it, let's take that fight. And so the honeymoon also turned into a vacation honeymoon. So, like, not a vacation, but like a training honeymoon. I was, you know, working out. Whenever I was swimming, I wasn't swimming for luxury or leisure. I was swimming for a training session. And, yeah, luckily for me, though, no surgery. I did not have to get surgery. They wanted me to get surgery. And I told them no. I had another doctor saying, well, you know, it's going to be a long time. You can't lift for at least a year, year and a half. It's going to be, you know, you got to get cortisone shots. It's going to be a long time before you can do anything again. I was like, fuck you. Literally. Like, I told my doctor buddy because he was like, you should get the cortisone shot. And I remember I was training. And I was like, as your friend, even though you're the doctor, as your friend, Jay, I'm going to tell you right now because his first name is Joshua, but I call him Jay. I had to tell him, I was like, fuck you, bro. I'm going to be lifting next week. And I started lifting. I started working out again. And even though it was, you know, painful, I kept lifting. I kept eating, kept recovering. And I gave my body, you know, everything that it needed. I was taking in more vitamins, more nutrition. I wasn't overtraining. I wasn't working out 2 hours, you know, in a row, high intensity anymore. And now I'm doing sessions where it's, you know, at least an hour to a half, hour and a half high intensity or strength training, rest a couple hours, work out anywhere between 30 minutes to an hour high intensity, rest a couple hours, and then, you know, do technical drilling for at least an hour. And it feels good. My body feels great. I don't feel like I'm getting any injuries or shutting down. So I feel like I'm going to be a lot stronger as an athlete going into this fight because I did more research on my own body. instead of just taking the doctor's advice and, you know, with them saying just take time off. Well, you can only take so much time off before you start to actually hurt yourself by not training. You know, you got to strengthen the injury. You got to strengthen the muscles around the injury. You got to strengthen the ligaments, everything around it. And that's what I did. So I'm glad I did it. I'm looking forward to this fight.
So a lot of shoulder injuries, a lot of back injuries, nothing that you like to hear. Orion Kosi going a little bit outside the bounds of what we know about science and health and all that, and just taking the matters into his own hands. And listen, the guy's definitely one of those confident guys that really feels in tune with his body. You see a lot of professional athletes take things this way, but for Orion Kosi, I mean, he definitely has his work cut out for him taking on Philip Rowe. And if you've seen anything from Orion Kosi, he considers himself the Goku of MMA. He's a team alpha male prospect. He is a big Dragon Ball Z fan. And the thing that I really found neat, he was a state champion wrestler and he went to senior nationals in high school at Hoopa High. You can go out and check out some of those wrestling videos on the YouTubes. But the big buzzwords for me when I watch Orion Kosi fight, it's power and it's explosiveness. And you see that in a lot of his shots. He's not a guy that's going to overwhelm you with his boxing combinations. It's going to be a lot of power to bridge the gap, to get a clinch, to get it on the mat. And you saw it in the fight against Dixon. He was a plus 270 underdog in that fight. Dixon definitely won the first round to me. The second round was close. I had it for Kosi. And then he just gets a takedown in the third round. Both guys are pretty tired. And he just ends it in, what was it, a man of crucifix? So for Orion Kosi, special fighter, he's normally southpaw, but he can switch between the two to orthodox, very patient. And again, three amateur fights, he wins them all by submission. As a pro, he's 7-0, but it's the reverse. Six wins by knockout, one by submission. I think he's got an interesting ceiling in this division, especially with his brother. And Matt, the one other thing that I want to say about Orion Kosi before I hand it off to you, and I remember we talked about this not long ago, there's a common thread between Philip Rowe and Orion Kosi, and it's the fact that Orion Kosi and his brother, Lewis, they both have back-to-back first-round submission wins over Daniel Williams. Who are the other brothers that have back-to-back wins over Danny Williams or Mick Williams? The Shabazzian brothers. The Shabazzian brothers. Just a couple of sets of brothers beating off Williams. So what are you thinking about this fight, Matt?
Wow, phrasing. So for Philip Rowe, this will be a really interesting matchup because he did not look good at all his last time out, and it left a sour taste in a lot of people's mouths because I know I thought he was going to look really good based on his Tuesday Night Contenders performance, because when you go out there and knock out Leon Shabazzian the way that he does, they have a wild back and forth fight too. Like, Contender Series tends to feel like you get a lot of squash matches where the, you know, heavy favorite goes out there and does what's expected of them, or every now and then, like maybe once a season, not even once a week, you have like a great underdog story, and then they get signed by the UFC. The Shabazzian Philip Rowe fight was just one of those back and forth great fights that did result in a great Philip Rowe knockout. And I thought, okay, great, we're gonna get like this crazy blood and guts type fighter. And he kind of showed shades of that in the Gabe Green fight, but Gabe Green to me, he's a very winnable fight. Like, I know. Whoa. He's probably better. He's better than the version of him that fought Daniel Rodriguez. Don't get me wrong at all. But
he was even good in that fight.
Exactly. He didn't look terrible in that fight, but I definitely thought Philip Rowe would at least make that a competitive matchup. And the problem with Philip Rowe is that he's a great guy when he's pressuring forward, but when he's the one being pressured, he can kind of struggle defensively. And it's really interesting with Orion Kosi, because you're bringing up some of the things that he does well, and I'm just trying to think of a comparison of a guy who's already in the UFC. And really the comp is early Ian Heinisch. Like, Ian Heinisch, before he tried to get Bangkok ready, it was a lot of that, okay, I'm going to strike my way on the outside, kind of box my way in, and then I'll crash into the clinch, and then I'll go for the takedown. I'm not going to say he fights just like Lewis Kosi, because, you know, that's too easy of a comparison, but there is that, okay, I'm going to brawl for brawling, and then I'm going to go for wrestling when I can't get that. And I think that's a very fun style. That's a style that's going to make a lot of fights closer than they probably should be that in your favor or against it, depending if you're fighting above or below your ranking. But for Orion Kosi, like, I really do feel like this is just a good introductory fight for UFC fans to him. He's coming off a lot of injuries. Philip Rowe should offer an interesting style matchup, but I don't think Philip Rowe's the type of guy who's going to go out there and defend 10 takedowns if Orion Kosi decides to take that kind of a game plan. I don't think Philip Rowe's the guy who can eat a lot of the big shots of Orion Kosi if he does get him up against the cage. So for Kosi, I really do see this being a very big showcase attempt for him.
when I went and looked at all the tape on Philip Rowe, and a lot of people are going to talk about this and let us know in the comment section for crazy, 8.5-inch reach advantage is what he's going to have. It's 71 inches for Kose compared to 80.5 for Rowe, but it's a question of, does he actually use it? I mean, we did see some odd striking defense in some of his fights. I know, especially in that Shabazzian fight. I mean, Shabazzian put it on him at certain points. Same thing with Green. And if you go back and watch that fight, Philip Rowe arguably won the first round. There were judges that gave it to him in that one. He ultimately loses 30-27 to 29-28, and he was outstruck in terms of total strikes, 128 to 48. But I go over to the Instagram, and I love the training partners because Matt, I mean, a Fight Night Picks favorite, Gerald Meerschaert, is over there training with him at Fusion XL. He also has Jared Gooden as well as Alex Pereira, you know, Joe Rogan's favorite kickboxer. So when I have a look at the odds for this one, Orion Kosi, almost a 2-1 favorite, around a minus 190. Philip Rowe at a plus 150. We have a look at those Tapology votes. Surprise to us as they are to you, Matt. 930 total votes, 83% Kosi, 74% by knockout for the 17% that have Rowe, 49% by decision, 28% by knockout, like 15% by submission. So I feel like you kind of tipped your hand here, but what are you thinking in terms of an overall pick?
I'm going to get say this before I get my prediction. Orion Kosi is going to make fights closer than they should be. And I really do mean that in a negative way. Like, it's kind of like the Daniel Rodriguez effect, where Daniel Rodriguez on his best day could probably beat guys in that like 15 to 10 range. But Daniel Rodriguez also could get clipped on the chin by like a UFC newcomer. It's just kind of how his style is. He will take damage. And I do see Orion Kosi as potentially being one of those guys who, listen, if just an explosive puncher in their UFC debut somehow gets matched up with Orion Kosi and he's like a minus 700 favorite, then you could maybe expect an upset in a situation like that. But I don't think Philip Rowe is the type of guy who has the power to really make Kosi pay for his aggressiveness or for his forward movement.
I mean, you look at it for Philip Rowe, the last time he was able to get the win, that was back last August, the win over Shabazzian. Before that, Matt McKeon, who's 4-5, Andrew Hellner, 1-2, Cole Milani, 0-3, Josh Zuckerman, 0-1, Ian Brofsky, 1-1. Do we want to play this game? I like the parts of Philip Rowe's game, but it's the same trouble that I had going into the fight against Gabe Green. I think Orion Kosi, I'm worried about those injuries. So for me to put any money on this fight, like, I just wouldn't. This is the most pop and popcorn fight on this entire card. The injuries scare me. The cardio, especially, again, both guys really laid it out there in the Dixon fight. And ultimately, Kosi gets a finish in the third round. I will go with Kosi, though, with that wrestling edge. But it is a tricky fight. And if you feel confident either way, well, let us know down below in the comment section, Matt. Both of us going with Orion Kosi to get the win. Galaxy to get the win. And I can't wait for this card, Matt. Moving up a weight class in the main event. You got a great one. And two really tricky fighters. Uriah Hall's taking on Sean Strickland. You're not going to want to miss that. And the rest of the videos in the playlist. So check them out. Keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks. And as we always say,
let's get into it.
Absolute banger of a fight on our prelims. This is a possible fight in the night, and this is like taking your over easy eggs, you put them on the hash browns, you mash them all up, because this is the biggest mismatch fight on the card. And I say mismatch because it's not a mismatch. This is a great one. Originally you had Trevin Jones. He was supposed to be taking on Tony Kelly, then Aaron Phillips. Now all of a sudden he gets Ronnie Lawrence. For Ronnie Lawrence, he was supposed to be taking on, well, one really tough out in John Castaneda. But Matt, here we are. And these guys put on absolute firework displays in their fights. For Trevin Jones, what was the read on him coming into the UFC? Because for me, he didn't look all that great. And then he fights Timur Valiyev. You could say a lucky punch. You could say a power jab. But it really was a power jab that hurt Timur Valiyev. And then his last time out, a flying knee knockout over Mario Bautista. Like, what are we doing here? So for Trevin Jones, he was a guy that I just couldn't wrap my mind around him. To me, he was one of those slow brooding type of fighters. He wasn't that great on the ground until he got himself into a good position. He wasn't that great on the feet until he clipped somebody. Now all of a sudden he's making moves and starting grooves in the UFC. And I'm making OMC references. So for this one, Matt, what are you saying about Trevin Jones here?
I think this is a very entertaining fight. And this fight could go so many different ways, because for Trevin Jones, that's the thing. Neither one of us had very high expectations for him coming into the UFC, but we can say that about a lot of people who have gone on to have great success. I know maybe Kyler Phillips' name doesn't look great this week, but at one point we both thought he was just going to be some flash in the pan. Okay, I should stop bringing up losses from the weekend, but Randy Costa, another guy who didn't have high expectations for, but he is a very good fighter. Trevin Jones is kind of in that category. Chaos Williams, another guy who he came into the UFC. It's like, okay, I think I know everything about this guy. And then he just starts knocking out people he's not supposed to knock out. And that's kind of the Trevin Jones effect. I think he's a much more technical fighter than people ever gave him credit for, especially on the feet, because he can sneak a lot of those shots up the middle. And even good fighters can't do that. But he's a guy who can consistently land uppercuts, knees up the middle. He does have decent boxing combinations. Listen, he's not going to go out there and out volume like, I'm trying to think, like Corey Sandhagen or anything in this division, but he is somebody who, with his wrestling and with his power punching, is offering up just an interesting look for a lot of guys. It's kind of like with Hakeem Olajuwon in the post. He didn't just have a move, he had a counter move too. Trevin Jones doesn't just have the move, he has the wrestling and the power. It's very Chad Mendes-esque, where he just gives you one of two options. Either A, you can focus the whole entire fight on defending takedown attempts, and yes, you might be the better grappler than he is, like I'm sure Ronnie Lawrence probably is, but I'm sure Ronnie Lawrence is going to spend the whole entire fight defending takedown attempts and getting back up from his feet. And Ronnie Lawrence, this will be really interesting. He's someone who, he can jump for that guillotine when Trevin Jones does shoot for his takedowns, and that's something that I'm watching out for, especially the submission attempts from Ronnie Lawrence. I don't love the power shots because it does leave him open to getting countered. And we've seen Trevin Jones, like, he can make a small window look pretty big in the striking. So if Ronnie Lawrence does find himself just lunging in with big power shots, I could see Trevin Jones just sparking him out with one punch.
Well, Matt, let's throw it on over to our original video where we introduce, this is like a rookie card, so you definitely want to keep it and collect it, of Ronnie Lawrence making his UFC debut against Vince Cachero. Ronnie Lawrence brings it, and if you look at his last three fights, they're not the same as his first few fights. This guy started his amateur career back in 2010, which is crazy to believe because you look at the last loss, he fought Steve Garcia, who's now in the UFC. That was back with Bellator. He took a lot of time off between that fight and his next fight. He's won three in a row. His second last fight with LFA, a very impressive performance. If you go back and watch that one against Garrett Arnfield, I mean, he's throwing heat. When he needs to get the takedown, he does. And then if you go back and watch his appearance on Dana White's Contender Series against Jose Johnson, that was one of those fights where Johnson was a huge favorite. Ronnie Lawrence was in around a plus 200 or more of an underdog.
And we know how Dana White Tuesday Night Contender Series is set up. Like, they do not normally want the underdogs to win.
No, so underdog Lawrence goes in there, and from the hop, they're talking about Johnson. He's a knockout artist. He's super long for the division. It's like looking at like a Cole Miller or an Ode Osborne. Like, the guy's super long, but he has the opportunity to knock you out. We'll choke. So Johnson goes in there, and Ronnie Lawrence just hooks up with him. He goes for the underhooks, body lock, takes him down. Like, Stevon's the guy to be into it. Hook him up. So you had a guy hooking him up. Ronnie Lawrence, great takedowns. He had 12 total takedowns in that fight. Wasn't able to keep Johnson totally down, but every time that Johnson popped back up, he took him back down. Looked amazing in that fight. I saw a few 30-26 scorecards in the mixes. It seemed like the commentary team thought there could be even more 10-8s, but for me, 30-27, really good fight. So he comes in here, and who do you match him up with? Like, you got a guy that's 6-1 in his career. You don't really know who to give him to. You take Vince Cachero. So a great counter for Trevin Jones. Again, he's such a tricky fighter to try and figure out on the feet, let alone the mat. And he's actually been training, getting ready for this one at Drysdale BJJ. Did I see Max Roshkoff in one of those pictures? And Extreme Couture. You love those combinations. Taking on Ronnie Lawrence. And when I was watching the Ronnie Lawrence tape over again, getting ready for this, Matt, I'm sure you'll be in agreement here. He's kind of like the American Merab Dvalishvili, because he just never stops trying to chain together takedowns, and he is an absolutely wild striker. And then the one point that I wanted to make, he has a Y Tiger Kung Fu background. He also had no high school or college wrestling experience. So he's like a young George St. Pierre and a young Roy Nelson all rolled into one. So I absolutely love this fight, Matt. In terms of the overall odds on this one, might be a little bit of a surprise to people. I figured Trevin Jones, he'd probably be a pretty decent favorite just considering the names that he's been able to beat in Bautista as well as Valiev. I'm not going to acknowledge that no contest is a loss or even a no contest. He beat Timur Valiev in that fight. He's a plus 120 underdog right now. Ronnie Lawrence, a minus 145 favorite. If we go over to Tapology, 862 total votes, 61% Jones, 72% by knockout. For the 39% that have Lawrence, 70% by decision. Matt, does any of that surprise you here?
It kind of does. Like, I thought I was going to be really clever and pick Trevin Jones as the pick as this, like, big underdog. I guess he's slight underdog. This fight comes down to cardio more than anything, if you really want to simplify it. Because if Trevin Jones can defend a lot of the takedown attempts and be the guy moving forward, then he should be the one winning this fight. Really, screw the takedown defense. Whoever's moving forward will be winning this fight. The only difference is that if Trevin Jones is moving backwards, he has shown me the ability to throw nice counter shots on the back foot and land with power on guys. So I guess for that reason, I have to pick Trevin Jones in this fight. And the fact that he is an underdog just makes it that much better.
Oh boy, Matt, I really like Ronnie Lawrence in the spot. And the reason being is I love Trevin Jones. Again, like you talk about it, when he's backing up, Timur Valiyev's throwing volume. He's throwing different looks. He's throwing his feints and his level changes in there. And Jones just doesn't have to react to any of those. He can just throw that one perfect shot. He can go against Mario Bautista, who I think really highly of in this division. Like, you have no idea how much that win means to me. This one is a little tricky, but when I look at it for Ronnie Lawrence, he's a guy that trains out of ATT Sunrise as well as Sanford MMA. If Trevin Jones is training a lot with Extreme Couture and Drysdale BJJ, I would think it would be for more of the defensive game planning. So for that reason, I like Ronnie Lawrence. This is a guy that doesn't stop pressuring you. He's like a mosquito in May. They're not going away. You got to get used to him. So I'm going with my mosquito. I'm going with Ronnie Lawrence. I love everything that he does. He does throw a little bit wild, like you said. So that is why I worry about him a little bit. But man, once this guy gets you down, well, it might take him like 12 more times to get you down, but that's the special X factor with a guy that can chain wrestle and has the cardio of a guy like Ronnie Lawrence. So I'm going to go with Lawrence. You're going to go with Jones. I want to hear from everybody down below in the comment section, because I think this fight is an absolute banger and it should deliver us a fight of the night. And we're split on this one, so I can't wait for it. We've got a big time main event coming up. Uriah Hall taking on Sean Strickland.
Ooh.
Are you kidding me? You're not going to want to miss that. So keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks. And as we always say,
let's get into it.
I absolutely love our next fight. We have a couple of debuting fighters that both competed on Dana White's Contender Series in 2020 in September of last year. It's Colin Anglin representing Michigan. He's going to be taking on Melzik Bogdazarian. Matt, for Melzik Bogdazarian, this is a guy that MMA fans might have seen on the periphery. He's a guy that trained with Ronda Rousey at the Glendale Fighting Center, as well as the Shabazian brothers. And for Melzik, man, this guy is just an absolute unit. He's from Armenia. He moved to the States at a really young age. So I threw it out there in terms of where these fighters are from or the countries that they represent. I saw that Melzik actually became a U.S. citizen over on the Instagram. So I wanted to honor that. I didn't want to hurt anybody's feelings, but I threw Armenia as well as the United States for his country. But Matt, I mean, holy smokes, what can this guy not do in terms of the striking game? He is a former, and I mean this in all sincerity, international champion. And if you look at it, he was a champ with WLF, which is an organization that we've kind of scratched our heads at in the past. But if you do look at it, he fought some really big names over there. He beat John Leong Q to win that WLF championship. And that guy has a really big name in terms of the overall game. You look at it, 3-0 pro boxing record, 9-2 in terms of kickboxing. Now, again, those are three-minute rounds, so they are shorter than all of MMA. And if you look at it, he does have the one loss to submission from 2014 when he made his young pro debut. That doesn't scare me off all that much, because I think what he tried to do, dip his toes in the water. It wasn't against a big name or a good opponent. He ended up losing that way. That's just a learning experience more than anything. I don't put too much stock into that. But Matt, I also have to say, I don't put too much stock into some of the wins. Combined opponent record in his four wins all in 2019 was 7-8. Two of those fighters were debuting fighters. He beat them in 14 seconds, 32 seconds, 9 seconds, 7 seconds. That's 62 seconds of fight time in four fights. He ended up coming over to Dana White's Contender Series. He picks up a win. It was a knock him out, drag him out type of fight. He beat the tar out of his opponent in the first round. And then the second round, it got a little bit closer. And then the third round, it got a little bit closer. He was actually the main event of that episode. And these were the fighters that were in that episode, Matt, that got contracts. Tucker Lutz, Ronnie Lawrence, William Knight, and Jimmy Flick.
Wow.
And the last thing I want to leave you with, Melzik Bogdasarian did not get a contract on that episode. Dana White said he wanted to have him back in November. Melzik was not on an episode back in November. He actually ended up getting signed to the UFC in March, and he posted that one on his Instagram. So I'm kind of up in the air on this one. Again, he trains out of the Muay Thai Gym of America in California, as well as Glendale with good old Edmund Tarverdian. So Matt, what are you thinking about our guy Melzik Bogdasarian? Because I didn't give a technical breakdown, and I can, because I watched all the short amount of tape, but also all the kickboxing I could find. This guy is a special fighter.
He needs experience, though, and like a lot of it. Like, that's the big problem with Melzik, is that in his MMA career, he does look somewhat green when it comes to like the things like takedown defense or even some of the grappling exchanges. Like, you can tell it's all very reactionary for him. Like, he doesn't exactly know what to do in the moment. It's like, okay, they shoot, they get to my hips. Okay, now I'm going to try to figure out how to defend this takedown. It's not like a guy like Corey Sandhagen, for instance, who would initiate the sprawl as TJ was coming in. Like, there's some things that you will just pick up as you have more fights under your belt. And I really do feel like Melzik Bogdasarian is one of those cases of he just needs more fights under his belt. And this fight against Colin Anglin should be really interesting, because for Melzik, he's a really long and rangy guy for this division. And it's weird, he's only listed at 5'9", but from the footage I watched, he looks to be as big of a featherweight as you can be. He's a heavily muscled guy.
So does Colin Anglin.
And exactly, that's what I was about to say. I feel like the majority of the time, Melzik, when he's in there, must feel like the bigger guy. But this is going to be one of those rare occasions where these are two of the bigger guys in the featherweight division. And honestly, I could see both of them moving up to lightweight as they get a little bit older, because this weight cut must be really hard on both guys. For Melzik, I kind of compare his striking a little bit, not exactly, to remember Prime Shogun when he was like throwing leg kicks and body kicks. And I understand he was orthodox, but he is a guy who he'll work a lot behind that back power kick, and then he'll set up his hands from it. He's not afraid to throw that check right hook when guys are moving forward on him. It's something that he can do too. He's good at throwing the knee up the middle when guys are moving forward. Like, he's a really dangerous striker off his back foot. And those are all going to be really important things, because in this fight against Colin Anglin, Anglin can strike. Don't get me wrong, he can strike. I don't think this is the fight he should be showing that off to us in. It's kind of like when Michael Venom Page fought Douglas Lima the first time around. Listen, I know Michael Venom Page is a good striker, but at that point in time, it was a little bit too much. Now, I understand rematch coming up in a little bit might get a different result, but we kind of figured out, okay, that bowl of porridge is too hot. We got to go find a new bowl. For Colin, I do really like his striking into the clinch. Again, I brought up before we even started filming, like, Martin Vettori is kind of like my, like, he's got black belt level striking into the clinch, you know? Like, he's just really, really good at, okay, I've got big shoulders, I'm defensively sound, I can get to that position.
And then it's like he's walking. It's like he's walking in your bowl of porridge, because he just gets stuck there in the clinch.
Yeah, exactly. Now, he does get stuck there, but at least he can get to that position and get his head out of trouble. The real question for Colin Anglin is, can he avoid the power strikes until he does get to the takedowns? Because I really think that once he gets his hands around Melzik's hips, I think he's going to be able to take him down relatively easily. And I do think he's going to be making Melzik work a lot off of his back with every single takedown attempt. So I really do think that every minute that ticks off this fight is going to favor Colin Anglin.
Well, we looked at it in terms of some of these guys that are debuting. We talked about it with Orion Cotsi. He was a big underdog in his Dana White Contender Series fight. So was Colin Anglin when he took on Naimov. And if you look at his overall body of work, 5 of his 8 wins are by finish since he turned pro in 2017. He had a fight against Sungmoo Choi booked earlier this year, but it ended up that things just didn't work out. That would have been a really tough fight. He's a Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu blue belt, Matt. Sometimes I like to go to the UFC's website, and when he talked about it, and these are the quotes, "When and why did you start fighting?" "Well, I started training in MMA after my first amateur fight." What?
Okay.
He went to Michigan State. He has a degree in criminal justice, and yeah, great for him. You love to see that. Go Spartans. I bet you he's a big Draymond Green fan. When I look at it, Matt, he has a wrestling background from high school. He also has the Factory X connection. So you'll see Mark Montoya in his corner. It's just going to be two great corners going at it. Mark Montoya, Edmund Tarverdian. Who's going to break first? I don't know. But if you look at it, his win over on Contender Series over Naimov, 129-28, 229-27s, where he was just firing away some unanswered damage. So I look at the odds for this one. Colin Anglin, open to -160 favorite. He's a +118 underdog right now. for Melzik Bogdazarian. Open a plus 140 underdog. He's a minus 144 favorite. If we have a look at the Tapology votes, I'm going to move my papers. It's a surprise to us as it is to you. Hey, 896 total votes, 66% Anglin, 77% by decision for the 34% that have Bogdazarian, 53% by decision, 36% by knockout. Matt, I'm surprised. Am I going to get juicy odds on Colin Anglin? I like that wrestling background.
Yes, yeah, so do I. And again, if Melzik wins, like, it's going to be a lot sexier first round knockout. If he wins. Oh, yeah, it's going to look way cooler. Like, the UFC is going to have a highlight that they can throw on Twitter, and ESPN can tweet about it, and we can tweet about
TikTok.
It. Just exactly. Like, it's going to be around. It's going to get around. But if Colin Anglin wins, it's probably going to be, like, a 30-25, like, you know, 12-17 takedown attempts, like one of those gritty type performances. Listen, a win's a win at the end of the day, but I'm sure the UFC has more eggs in Melzik's basket than they do in Colin Anglin's. But I do agree with you. I like Colin Anglin here.
Colin Anglin, let's see what's in your basket. We're going with the guy from Michigan in this fight. I can't wait for it. Let us know down below in the comment section. You're going with the purest of pure strikers. This guy's one of the best kickboxers you're going to see in the sport, and he's taking on one really tough out, Colin Anglin. Both of us going with a Michigan man. You're not going to want to miss the rest of the videos, including our main event video preview of Uriah Hall. He's going to be taking on Sean Strickland. I say video, but you can check us out. We're on iTunes. We're on Spotify. I got us back on the Google Podcast app. Let's go. You can find us there as well. Keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks. And as we always say,
let's get into it.
Big time fight coming up this weekend in the strawweight division. We have the spider monkey, Ashley Oder. She's going to be taking on Fortis MMA's own Jinyu Fry. Matt, for Jinyu Fry, plenty of Fortis MMA fighters on this card, including Cheyenne Bays, as well as one half of your main event, Uriah Hall. And listen, Saif Saud is going to be busy on the weekend. For Jinyu Fry, picked up her first UFC win in her last fight. She had a big one over Gloria DePaola, who's also on this card, taking on her teammate, Cheyenne Bays. Now, Matt, if you look at it for the five-on-in for both these women, it is not the sexiest of record. For Jinyu Fry, she lost to Ayaka Hamasaki, but that's an all-time legend. She beat Smashley, Ashley Cummins. So if we're talking in terms of wins over Ashley's, who's got the more recent one? I mean, unless Ashley beat herself, like maybe she's trying to beat some records. It's going to be Jinyu Fry. And if you look at it, the two losses in the UFC, Kay Hansen, Loma Lookman, me, and really the story in those ones, Jinyu Fry didn't look terrible against Kay Hansen until she got finished. But in her fight against Loma Lookbunmi, she just looked kind of like Keith Richards-ish. And when I make those references, it's the old start me up reference. It's like, and then it just keeps going like that. And nothing gets started up. For Jinyu Fry, she just wasn't able to get going. For Ashley Oder, you look at it, two wins, Siri Kondo, Miranda Granger, the losses, Randa Marcos by split, Lavinia Souza, as well as one Angela Hill in her last time out. And that wasn't all that long ago, but 4 months and a week ago when she loses to Overkill Hill. So a couple of fighters that don't have the greatest records coming into this one, even overall. For Ashley Oder, 8-7. For Fry, 10-6. She's the former Invicta atomweight champion, not even strawweight, atomweight champion. Matt, Jinyu Fry coming into this fight, Fortis MMA. You're taking on Team Quest, Dan Henderson's Performance Fitness Center, whatever they call it these days. What are you thinking on this one?
This should be an interesting fight. You know, like, I was excited for when Jinyu Fry came over to the UFC. I followed her in Invicta to a certain degree. It's not like I was married to her run or anything, but I was somewhat interested in her career. That's more than I can say for a lot of Invicta champs. So she must have been doing something right. And when she made the transition, you could just kind of tell, you know, from the first weigh-in, like, hey, this isn't her division. The UFC does not have the division that she belongs in. She can be an okay fighter at strawweight, but she can never be a great fighter at strawweight. She could be a great fighter at atomweight. And the weird thing about atomweight, too, is it does feel like there's a massive difference between atomweight and strawweight compared to, like, strawweight and flyweight. There's a big difference between even strawweight and flyweight, but, like, the atomweight fighters, you can tell, it's just barely any of them are over, like, 5'3". There's a massive size and reach disadvantage that a lot of them have to overcome. And the issue with a lot of these fights is strawweight is they come down to volume. Well, if I'm the shorter fighter who has trouble reaching my target, I'm never going to really win that fight when it does come down to volume. And this is what I have to say about Ashley Oder. It feels like every time she wins a fight and then she's announcing, like, oh, I'm going to go on a run. Like, it never happens, though. After the Miranda Granger fight,
maybe it happens this weekend.
But it's like, it was like some kids started taking off for a race and they were doing really great. And then all of a sudden the ref was like, no, I didn't blow the whistle. It's like you're kind of counting your eggs before they've hatched. Like, she wins against Brandon Granger, and she's like, okay, listen, my training wasn't great, but I figured it out, guys. I'm going to go on a run. And then Angela Hill destroys you. It's not even a competitive fight. And listen, Angela Hill's a good fighter, but you need to at least have a competitive fight with Angela Hill if one day you want to be considered a top 15 strawweight. And you haven't even been able to show that ability through a UFC run. Like, Ashley Yoder's been in the UFC for a while now, I guess is my point. And she's never really been able to do enough to differentiate herself from just an unranked strawweight. Listen, I don't hate her volume. I think she might even have underrated power in this division. Look at her knockdown of Mackenzie Dern in their fight, a fight that Craig will never forget and never stop bringing out that Ashley Yoder should have won. But it's just Ashley Yoder's never really gotten better at the things that we thought she was going to get better at. She still has the range, but that was just kind of a physical attribute she has. She still has decent volume, but I wouldn't even say it's great, because when you look at her against other great volume fighters in this division, she gets out volume. So I'm going to say this. I think Ashley Yoder's going to win this fight only because she's bigger. And I know that's not a great technical analysis, but that's really what this fight's going to come down to.
Ashley Yoder, one of those tricky strikers when she's on her back foot too. She's a really weird southpaw to try and figure out. You talk about the size. She's got 4 inches in terms of height. She's got what? About 4.5 inches in terms of the reach. Great stuff out of old Smashley. She's not Ashley Cummins, but Matt, when we have a look at the odds for this one, Ashley Yoder open a -140 favorite. She's somewhere around a -137. The odds haven't changed all that much. Virginia Frye opened a +120. She's now a +112. And if you have a look over on Tapology, 952 total votes. The fans are split 52% for Virginia Frye, and then for Ashley Yoder, 48%. Pretty well all of them by decision. If I was going to put anything on this one, it's for the fight to go to decision. These are decision machines. Did Mina Grusander beat Virginia Frye once? Maybe. Did she put on little stink bomb performances beforehand? Yeah, maybe she did. I don't know. It's been said. I don't know. Ask Drake Riggs. But Matt, when I have a look at this fight, I'm in agreement with you. For Ashley Yoder, is the takedown defense the greatest?
No.
Not against the upper echelon. So if Jinyu Frye has a snowball's chance in hell, she really has to put on a lot of pressure. She did great against a striker in her last fight in Glory DePaola, who's also on this card. So that's a little bit of the point. She's also going to be training with Cheyenne Bays. I think that's a good person to train with for this fight. As silly as all this might sound, it's true. It really is true. But for Ashley Yoder, again, she's been there and done that against some of the better fighters in this division. And again, say what you want to get about the Mackenzie Dern fight, I still think that she won. Matt, both of us going with the Spider Monkey. In this one, are we absolutely nuts? The fight is close in terms of the odds. So you let us know, because last weekend we got bit by Hannah Goldie and Diana Belbizia. So what do we know? But I do like this one in terms of, you know, kind of what's next for both of these women in the division. We're really going to learn that this weekend as well. Is what's going to happen in the top of the middleweight division. We have Uriah Hall. He's going to be taking on one tough out in Sean Strickland. So you're not going to want to miss that. You're going to want to keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks. And as we always say,
let's get into it.
Truthfully, if I wanted a weight on my desk, I'd probably opt for a piece of granite, some other type of stone. Not a featherweight, but Matt, we have a big time featherweight fight coming up this weekend. Danny Chavez taking on Kai Kamaka III. And Matt, for Kai Kamaka III, we had a great interview with our own JHK MMA before his last fight. Unfortunately for him, he came out on the losing end against one downtown TJ Brown. And for the Fighting Hawaiian and Kamaka, while he did win in a fight of the night against Tony Kelly in his UFC debut, he implemented a lot of his wrestling. He earned 5 total takedowns in that fight. He got mollywopped in his next time out by Jonathan Pierce. He got finished in the second round. He loses a split decision his last time out against TJ Brown. Again, Adelaide Bird, what are you doing? There was a 30-27 in there from Adelaide Bird, a 29-28 from Sal D'Amato, 29-28 from Mike Bell. But ultimately, it is TJ Brown picking up the win. I remember watching that fight thinking, well, yeah, TJ Brown won that fight. For Danny Chavez, Matt, I had a really hard time trying to approximate his ceiling in the UFC. And if we're playing MMA math, well, TJ Brown beat Kai Kamaka and Danny Chavez beat TJ Brown. So Bob's your uncle and see you later. That's the show. But Matt, that's not so. Danny Chavez takes TJ Brown down. Now, Brown had a bad weight cut in that fight, right? So that was one of those initiators that I would think as to why Danny Chavez really pulled away. But if you look at his next time out, He gets controlled on the ground by Jared Gordon. And I'm not saying that Jared Gordon is a slouch by any means, but Jared Gordon was all, Jared Gordon looked like an all world, like an all pro. They should send him to like the top featherweight camp. They should really, Jared Gordon, front of the line. But really, when I watched that fight, it was like, okay, Danny Chavez did not look very good. So was it an isolated incident? I know you were really high on Chavez coming into the UFC. I really want to get your take on what you thought about that fight in particular against Jared Gordon. And really what we could get in this one, because you know that Kai Kamaka is going to come with a wrestle-heavy offensive training out of Extreme Couture.
I do, but like, what's Kai Kamaka good at? You know?
Wrestling. And wrestling.
He is, but I've seen him get taken down too many times to stamp him as a good wrestler. Like, I saw him get taken down, what, 5 times against Brown? Like, he's been taken down quite a few times in the UFC. I don't neglect that he has wrestling training. He has a wrestling background. But when I've seen you get out wrestled against guys like TJ Brown and against guys like Jonathan Pierce took me down 5 times.
2 of 4, yeah, 2 of 4 by TJ Brown. It was 5 of 7 for Jonathan Pierce in that fight.
This is my point. You can't be billed as a boxer or as a kickboxer and get knocked out in boxing and kickboxing exchanges. You can't be called a wrestler and have me see you get out wrestled on multiple occasions. Like, Jonathan Pierce isn't that great of a grappler. Look at what Joe Lauzon did to him. I know Joe Lauzon, if he's going to beat you, that is how he's going to beat you. But my point is that Kai Kamaka, yes, we talk about his wrestling, but I've seen him get taken down a bunch of times. I've seen him tire going for takedowns. And on the feet, listen, he has decent power, but I don't think he has like this crazy power that people think. Kai Kamaka barely has any wins by knockout when you really look at it. Like, he has a lot of decision wins, and a lot of the time it is, I'm going to go out there, I'm going to hurt my opponent maybe once, and then I'm going to try to hold him up against the cage and try to get clinch control. It's not an ineffective way of winning fights, but like, I don't think Kai Kamaka is gonna have a lot of wins at the UFC level. I've made hot takes before, I'll make them again, but I really do think Danny Chavez is at least a UFC caliber fighter. If Jared Gordon's gonna beat you, he's gonna beat you by going out there, getting takedowns, having top control, beating you with that top pressure. Look at how he beat Hakran Diaz. I know Hakran Diaz never really turned out in the UFC, but like, Hakran Diaz was a very, very, very good fighter, and Jared Gordon beat him in that very, very similar manner. So I really do feel like this is one of those buy low, sell high type situations with Danny Chavez and where the odds are at. I think he's a much better fighter than he demonstrated in his last fight. And honestly, I think he's much better than Kai Kamaka in most areas of MMA.
For Kai Kamaka, 7 total wins by decision, 1 by submission. It was really early on in his career. For Danny Chavez, again, if you have a look down through it, beat TJ Brown, beat Dylan Calla to get into the UFC. I was really impressed by the win over Pipe Vargas over with XFN back in 2018. You look at some of the losses, Adi Alici, Jason Soares, who should have ended up in the UFC, maybe. Did Dana White not like him on Looking for a Fight? I don't know. And Jordan Parsons, which is really unfortunate because Jordan Parsons was a really promising prospect, and he was really gone too soon. But when I look at this one, I mean, for Danny Chavez, 8 wins by decision, 3 by knockout. It seemed like he was some like knockout artist when he started to come into the UFC, because again, Calla, Pipe Vargas, Leandro Magalhães, those were his 3 wins coming in. And those are his only ones by knockout. So maybe you like that MMA Masters connection. Obviously, his teammate's going to get a shot at the belt again at 170 pounds. So that one's weird. But Matt, when we have a look at this one, odds open at par. Chavez now the underdog at roughly a minus 103 on best fight odds. For Kamaka, a minus 120 is the return. Over on Tapology, 840 total votes, 67% Chavez to 33% Kamaka. For the 67% that have Chavez, 80% by decision. And for the 33% that have Kamaka, it's 72% by decision. We might actually end up with a finish here. Who gets tired first? Who's able to gain top position? Who's able to finish their opponent?
I think Dan Chavez is the much higher likelihood of going out there and getting a finish. I know Kamaka showed some power in his last fight. He did have Brown hurt in their last fight, but again, he couldn't capitalize on it after he got them hurt. Kamaka has that like knockdown type power, but when he does try to explode after hurting somebody, he tends to hurt his gas tank more than his opponent, if anything, and it almost becomes a net negative at the end. So I really do think Danny Chavez, just by being the much smarter fighter, can win this fight. Keep distance. Don't let Kamaka get his hands around you. Keep your back off the cage, and I think this can be not an easy fight, but I do think Chavez has been in much harder fights than this one.
8-year age gap between these two guys. The one fighter representing Miami at 34, you have Pearl City, Hawaii's Kakamaka the third at 26. I love the wrestling pedigree, but it's been tough for me to see it in the UFC. That's the thing that scares me away from it. I know in the story of Kakamaka, he finally made the move over to the mainland permanently. He's living in Vegas. He's training in Vegas. And he had that split decision fight against TJ Brown. I'm going to go with the guy in the MMA mass sphere that has the win over TJ Brown. I'm going to go with Danny Chavez in this one. But again, this is one that I stay away from. And maybe I live bet it after like the first round, maybe the second round. Like, it really depends on gas tank cardio in this one. I can't wait for the fight, but both of us going with the Colombian warrior and Danny Chavez is currently the underdog in this fight. I can't wait for the fights this weekend, Matt. Paperweight, featherweight, Granite Rock. We've got a big fight at featherweight here. And in our main event at middleweight, you have Uriah Hall primetime taking on Tarzan Sean Strickland. Can't wait for it. Keep locked in with Fight Name Picks, as we always say.
Let's get into it.
We have a Ben Askren type fight coming up at lightweight because this one is a little bit funky. We have Chris Gritz Gritzmacher taking on the man himself. They call him Gifted Rafa Garcia. And Matt, I absolutely love this matchup because for Rafa Garcia, this guy came in with a full head of steam from Combate in short notice, loses to Nasrat Haqparast, 130-27, 229-28, but he landed some nice shots from the outside. He was a smaller fighter in terms of the rangier boxer that is Nasrat Haqparast. But Matt, I feel like we had a pretty good read on Rafa Garcia, and I want to give him his due. Let's throw it back to his rookie card performance. Let's reintroduce the man known as Rafa Garcia. Let's talk about Mexico's Rafa Garcia. Matt, this was a guy that back in October on early stoppage, we threw out a fan Q&A. We said, throw us your questions. We'll give you the answers. Friend of the show at Trademark MMA on Twitter, Max Friedman, threw out the question, asked about some of the prospects that were coming up in just MMA in general. So I threw out a list of prospects. Rafa Garcia fell on that list. This was a guy, former Combate lightweight champ. He was able to win the belt against Eric Gonzalez, you know, Ghost Pepper, and he defended against Humberto Bandanai, former UFC vet. And he has a couple of those grimy wins against guys that you know from the UFC. So you look at Rafa Garcia, undefeated 12-0. He was 8-0 over with Combate. Those title fights, only 3 rounds. But he's really able to bring things together. And the thing that I like out of Rafa Garcia, he's a guy out of Mexicali, Mexico, that's really kind of moved around for his training. They actually brought him in at Team Elevation. And this is going to sound crazy because you thought, well, Usman was brought in to train with Justin Gaethje to get him ready for UFC 254. They also brought Rafa Garcia in to get Justin Gaethje ready. Now, it backfired for Gaethje. But if you're a guy like Rafa Garcia, that only helps you. He trains out of the training lab with who? TJ Dillashaw, Juan Archuleta, Cub Swanson. I've seen him at Gracie Baja HQ with Naaman Gracie. I've seen him all over the place training with these high-level athletes. You'll love to see it for Rafa Garcia. His last fight was last February, the fight against Bandanai. So we haven't seen him in a long time. Again, in June, he kind of declared he was a free agent. It was about the same time that Gustavo Lopez got into his tough issue where he was still a part of Combate, ended up in the UFC. They got their Combate champ in Gustavo Lopez. They had to wait a little bit longer for Rafa Garcia. But I'm excited to see him. And if you want an exciting fighter, Rafa Garcia is the type of guy that's just going to chase you down. Like, he is like Wile E. Coyote after a carrot. I guess it was really the Roadrunner that would follow a carrot. He's like somebody going after a carrot. Like, if you're on a treadmill going after a carrot. Let's just talk the talk about the carrots. Rafa Garcia just, he will find you in a cage. And listen, I think in a lot of instances, the smaller cage would probably help out a guy like Rafa Garcia. You see it in his fights. Again, the Gonzalez and the Bandanai fight are very good examples because he has a ton of finish wins and by submission as well. I mean, 7 of his 12 wins by submission. But for Rafa Garcia, when he's striking, he does a good job with his lead foot position. He really corners you. If he wants to work a takedown, maybe not the best from open space, but when he does get in the clinch, he does a great job.
And that's the problem. We talk about some wrestlers who are really good at striking their way into distance and then going for the takedown attempt, and then other wrestlers who they just kind of put their head down and go for the takedown, kind of like what Curtis Blaydes did in that last takedown attempt against Derek Lewis, where it was just so obvious what he was going for. Rafa Garcia, earlier on in the fight, he still has that explosion, and he is able to go for some of those takedowns in open space, but a lot of his bread and butter and his takedown attempts are going to come from that clinch, and he does have a really nice inside trip. It reminds me a little bit of Henry Cejudo. Now, he's not nearly at Henry Cejudo's level, of course, for wrestling, but it's one of those cheeky little takedowns that a lot of people aren't going to be able to traditionally defend because it does come from such an unorthodox position. The problem with Garcia, though, is he's not good at striking his way into the clinch to try to initiate those wrestling transitions, and when you are fighting a guy like Nasser Hackbrass, who can keep a very high volume throughout a fight, has really good cardio himself, and also has really good footwork, it's going to be tough to try to walk him down like he has been doing in his last fights. And Garcia does have that kind of zombie mentality where he's always going to be going forward no matter what. When you're fighting a guy like Nasser Hackbrass, who can not only use his feet, but also his head to try to bait you into exchanging with him in the pocket, it's going to be a tough night out for Garcia.
All right, so you get a bit of a lowdown on Rafa Garcia. He really is a special fighter, and he's going to be taking on a guy that, Matt, I feel like we had a weird read on him going into his last fight against Alexander Hernandez, because my question was, so you beat Joe Lozon in 2018, then you're supposed to fight Benil Dariush. That fight falls out. Unfortunately, you had an injury to Gritsmacher. Then in 2019, you're supposed to take on Jesus Pinedo. But Gritsmacher's out due to an ACL. And then he gets Alexander Hernandez years later. They box it out. They slug it out. And he gets knocked out in the first round. So for Chris Gritsmacher, Matt, listen, people either love or loathe your hot takes. But I remember your hot take before the Hernandez fight as to, well, Chris Gritsmacher's billed as a boxer, but his boxing ain't all that sexy. So what do you think here?
And my take was pretty spot on, wasn't it? This is the thing with Chris Gritsmacher. You ever watch like Planet Earth documentaries? Like, I'm a big fan of them. And sometimes at the start, there'll be like a caribou and you don't really know what's going to happen. Maybe that caribou is going to go on, live a happy caribou life. Maybe it's going to get eaten by a bunch of wolves. With Chris Gritsmacher in his last fight, you kind of knew he was going to get eaten by a bunch of wolves because Chris Gritsmacher is a basic fighter. He's not, there's nothing bad about that. But what Chris Gritsmacher does is very basic. He moves forward, he throws power shots, he kind of works behind the jab, but he's very stiff with it. So it's not like he really flicks his jab out at long range. He's not a guy who can really pick you apart with it, like we saw Randy Costa do, at least in the first round against Adrian Yanez. He doesn't do that with his jab. He tries to get on the inside and try to sling up power shots. But the issue with Chris Gritsmacher is that he squares up his stance when he does that. Like, normally, if you're a boxer, your feet are like this, right? You have one kind of behind the other. You're standing like this. Gritsmacher squares his feet up. Like, he just squares them up. So his shoulders are square, and he's very susceptible to being hit when he's in that position. I know other fighters can get away with that. Like, when Poirier gets guys hurt, he can kind of square up and force them against the cage. That works when you're Dustin Poirier and you have crazy power and volume to go along with it. When you're Chris Gritsmacher, the holes in your defense are not worth the offense in which they open. And I don't think it's going to help him in this fight against Rafa Garcia. He looked great against Joe Lozon, but go back and watch that Joe Lozon fight. Joe Lozon was so far past the hill, he couldn't even see it anymore. And Chris Gritsmacher at least had youth on his side in that. And he was able to bust at the face of Joe Lozon. And that was one of those performances that made Gritsmacher look better than I really think he is. And Alexander Hernandez brought him back down to earth. I know some of the matchmaking was weird and he was supposed to fight Benil Dariush. We all know how that Dariush fight would have gone, right? Like, the odds would have been, yeah, I see Craig's eyes. Dariush would have been a minus 7,000?
Yeah, it would have gone just like the fight against Artem Lobov on The Ultimate Fighter. Like, that's just the tricky thing. And I mean, I look at Gritsmacher in the UFC. He beats Abner Lavares, who's no longer in the UFC. He beats Joe Lozon. He loses by submission to Chaz Skelly and Davi Hamosh. And stuff like that's going to happen, and that's understandable. You're going to get submitted by guys like that. That's all right. But it just really is tricky for me to go out there and pick a guy whose last win was, what, over 3 years ago? But like almost three and a half years ago. And then I look at the odds for this one. I wish I got Rafa Garcia earlier. He opened a minus 175. He's a minus 269 favorite at this point. For Chris Gritsmacher, opened a plus 150. He's a plus 215 right now. Over on the Tapologies, Matt, it's a surprise to us as it is to you. I'm going to scroll down. 976 total votes. 90% Garcia, 49% by decision, 23% by submission, 22% by knockout. For the 10% that have Gritsmacher, 72% by decision. I think Rafa Garcia wins in every aspect of this fight. And if I'm wrong, I look like a donkey. And we're going back to Rodolfo Vieira territory when he lost, well, his first loss against Fluffy Hernandez. I'll say this, just like I said in that video. If Chris Gritsmacher beats Rafa Garcia, I become the biggest Chris Gritsmacher stan there's ever been out there. But for right now, I like the guy that's training with some of the biggest names in the world in Rafa Garcia that they bring into training camps to get a good feel for guys, but actually wins in the cage. I like Rafa Garcia in this one, Matt.
Hey, Chris, I wrote you, but you still ain't calling. I love my cell, my pager, and my home phone at the bottom. I couldn't imagine. I like Rafa Garcia a lot in this fight. And listen, he had one of those underrated performances his last time out. I understand it's a loss on his record, but you can gain knowledge in a loss. And he did a really good job at least countering some of the flurries of Nasrat Haqparast, because what we know Haqparast for is he's really good at darting in, blitzing, and darting out. And at least Garcia was making him pay for it on some of those occasions. Although those shots didn't put Haqparast down, I think those same shots will do more than enough to hurt Grootsmacher. I like Garcia quite a bit in this fight.
Both of us going with the Baja California's own, Matt, Rafa Garcia, to get the win. I can't wait for this fight. You get a better idea of the up-and-comers in the lightweight division. Can the veteran throw it on back? Do I become the biggest Chris Grootsmacher fan in this entire world? Are we going to go with gifted Rafa Garcia out of a litany of different gyms? Both of us are. You let us know down below in the comment section who you're going with. And Matt, in the main event at middleweight, we have primetime Uriah Hall, a guy that just beat Anderson Silva and Chris Weidman back to back. How crazy is that? Legend killer tour. He's going to be taking on one really tough out in a streaking Sean Strickland. So you're not going to want to miss that. You keep locked in with Fight Night Picks. And as we always say, let's get into it. Big time fight coming up this weekend at Bantamweight. We have a couple of heavyweight gyms going at it. It's Syndicate MMA taking on Team Oyama. Matt, you have no idea how hard I had to search for that. Try and guess where I got the info that Wu Yanan is now training at a Team Oyama. And listen, I want to say this first. If you've watched any Wu Yanan fight, especially your last few fights, it's the fact that the broadcast will say she has bounced around from gym to gym to gym. Yeah. She used to train at Phuket Top Team. She spent time at the Shanghai PI. It took me a really long time to try and figure this one out. How do you think I got it?
Instagram.
It was friend of the show, Drake Riggs. Nope. Wow. Couldn't find anything on Instagram. Nothing on Facebook. I tried Baidu. I tried Sohu. I tried as many websites as I could. I tried spelling her name in English. I tried it in Chinese. I couldn't find a damn thing. So credit where credit's due. Drake Riggs, one of the best ones out there on the internet and a true friend of the show. Now, Matt, for Wu Yanan, I think that's great, because who's she going to be training with to get ready for some of these fights? Well, Carlos Sparza trains there. Luis Smolka trains there. Who else do we have? Former title challenger, Perez, he trains there, flyweight. So there's a lot of really great people there. But Colin Oyama's trained a lot of big names, and he's one of those guys that a lot of people don't really think of at the forefront of the MMA scene when they pick some of these big gyms. But honestly, I set this up as heavyweight gyms. I think he's right up there with some of the best of them. And for Syndicate MMA, I mean, one half of your main event coming up this weekend trains at Syndicate in Sean Strickland, but there's a lot of great names there. One of which, the former inaugural UFC flyweight champion, Nico Montano. Matt, for Nico, the weigh-ins were the issues. The injuries were the issues. They took her belt away from her. The UFC definitely didn't treat her all that well. I really don't like what I saw from them. And then all of a sudden, she finally comes back after a really long layoff. The Roxanne Modafferi fight where she wins. She takes on Juliana Pena. And oh, by the way, that was 2 years ago. So she loses to your title challenger, which is silly in and of itself. But she loses to Juliana Pena. And now we're here and you're taking on Wu Yanan. So it really is a tricky one for me. Nico Montano's last win, 3 years and 7 months ago. So what are you saying here?
I have no idea what version of Nico Montano we're going to get. And anybody who tells you they do is just lying to you. They're straight up lying to your face, because she hasn't looked good in almost 4 years. The Pena fight, we didn't see anything from her. She was just on the receiving end of a bunch of takedown attempts, and she did all right enough defensively to not get submitted by Juliana Pena. But if we've seen anything out of Juliana Pena's game recently, it's that she herself can also get out grappled. Look at the Valentina Shevchenko fight. Look at the Jermaine Duranemi fight. Like, Juliana Pena,
look at the first round of her fight against Nico Montano, where Nico Montano has 4 minutes and 7 seconds of control time and outstrikes her, doubles it, and then after that it goes downhill and Juliana Pena takes over.
Exactly. The problem with Nico Montano at 135 pounds is that it's just not sustainable, I don't think. Like, down at 125, I really do feel like she's similar to Sajara Eubanks, where it's just that right mixture of I've got good size for the division, but I'm not really killing myself to make the weight cut. And I understand with these two, they are extreme weight cuts, so it would be a big issue. But with Montano, it's just physically against most 135ers, the takedown defense is going to be an issue. The takedown offense is going to be really hard. It's going to be harder for her to go out there and take down her opponents. And Frederica Montano, go back and look at her fight against Roxanne Modafferi. She did a great job of mixing everything up. She fought like a fighter who didn't just have six fights on their record. She fought like a fighter who had like 10, 15 fights on their record. But the issue is that I haven't seen you in almost 4 years fight at your peak ability. In the Pena fight, you look good in that first round. But again, I've seen Juliana Pena get out grappled by Jermaine Durandamy and Valentina Shevchenko. Shevchenko's a good grappler, but the fact that JDR submitted her really taints Juliana Pena's opinion in my mind. And for Roxanne Modafferi, I think that was a great win for Nico Montano. And I'm sure that was closer to Modafferi's prime than a lot of other Modafferi performances in the UFC happened. But it's hard for me to say, oh, that's the fighter I'm going to get out of Nico Montano her next time out. Like, I'm going to get the one who was able to mix in the takedown attempts and her striking up at 135 pounds like she was able to do 4 years ago. That was a long time ago. And against Wu Yannan, listen, against Jocelyn Edwards, that was a weird fight where Edwards was by far the better striker, but she's moving backwards and she gets kind of tired. Wu Yannan was never able to close the distance in an effective way in that fight. She just kind of rushes forward throwing punches and then she'd miss, reset, and that would be it. And then she just do it over and over and over again. The only thing that I know in this fight is that Nico Montano should be able to make better predictions during the fight or be able to make in-fight reads better than Wu Yannan can. And I guess I have to pick her because of it.
So for Nico Montano, she made her MMA, her pro MMA debut at the end of 2015 against Stacy Sagala, who was 1-2. Those are your debuting fights. You're going to get fighters like that. Then she fights a 1-0 Pam Bam Sorensen. Great fighter over with Invicta, loses by split decision. She beats Shanna Dobson. She beats Jamie Milinowski. She loses to Julia Avila. And this is before the UFC and the Ultimate Fighter. Then she goes in the Ultimate Fighter, beats Lauren Murphy, Montana De La Rosa, Barb Honchak, and Roxanne Modafferi to win the title. And then she's booked against Macy Chason, Julia Avila a bunch of different times. She was booked against Carol Hosa earlier on this year. Not medically cleared to fight was Montano. Now you get Wu Yannan. My biggest knock on Wu Yannan, switching camps all the time, being really young at 125 pounds and not being able to bring it together. I mean, for Wu Yannan, she picked up decent wins outside of the UFC against competition you expected her to beat. Like, she was getting finishes. We talk about this all the time. She lost to Yana Kunitskaya in the second round of their fight in 2016 with Fight Spirit Championship 6. But that's going to happen, right? Like, Yana's a good bantamweight. Beats Angela Pink, and then we end up, she fights Gina Mazzani. She loses that fight. She finishes Lauren Mueller, one of Matt's favorite fighters. Loses to Mizuki Inoue by split decision, then loses to Jocelyn Edwards. And the thing for me out of all of it, you look at it, her takedown defense is 66%, but against really good wrestlers, I mean, we saw Gina Mazzani just go to the well, go to the well, go to the well. Wu Yannan gets a takedown on Jocelyn Edwards, but Jocelyn outstrikes her, as you would imagine. Wu Yannan outstrikes Mizuki Inoue. I thought she won that fight. I went back and watched that one. Mizuki really hasn't looked all that great in the UFC. And then Lauren Mueller, well, poor Lauren Mueller just didn't have a great run in the UFC. She was a nurse. She does good work. But she wasn't all that great. So negative strike differential for Wu Yannan. Maybe not the greatest with the takedowns. Obviously, Nico Montano is going to come in with that wrestling. It's just, what the hell is she going to look like on the scale? What are we going to get on Saturday? It's way too tough to tell. For somebody that hasn't won in 3 years and 7 months, you got to feel pretty damn confident picking them to win. Like, this isn't Miesha Tate territory. This is like, I worry. Nico Montano, open to minus 225 favorite. She's minus 237 at best fight odds. For Wu Yannan, open to plus 190. She's roughly a plus 188. I know those odds don't seem to make sense, but that's what they had. And if you have a look over on Tapology, it's a surprise to me as it is to you. 954 total votes, 79% Montano, 90% by decision for the 21% that have Wu Yannan, 77% by decision. Listen, I'll go wrestling over the striking. I'll go with Nico Montano. I think she's going to be able to do a lot of work on the ground. Wu Yannan's not great off her back. When she's on her back, she tends to stay on her back. I mean, yeah, Gina Mazzani gets 5 takedowns. You got to get up at some point. But I can't go with Wu Yannan. Love the move to Team Oyama. If we see a wrinkle in her game, she's in the same category in this fight as Chris Grutzmacher was for me. I'm just going to be the biggest Wu Yannan fan moving forward, but I got to go with Nico Montano here. And even in that, at minus 237, you are a silly goose if you decide to wager on that one. It's pop and popcorn all day.
Nico Montano's beat far better fighters than Wu Yanan is. And Wu Yanan should just be her introduction into the 135-pound weight class, because the Pena fight shouldn't have happened. Like, that's a weird fight to have your debut at 135 pounds. This feels like a much better fight for her. This feels like the UFC at least trying to set her up to win a little bit compared to what they've been doing in the past. So for all those reasons, I do like Nico Montano.
Both of us going with Nico Montano, the former UFC flyweight champion. It's weird to say that because it seems like Valentina's forever been the champ, but no, no. Nico was the first. Will she be the last? Well, no, Valentina probably will be. Matt, we've got a big-time fight coming up this weekend in the women's bantamweight division. Both of us going with Montano in this one in our main event at middleweight. Primetime, taking on Tarzan, Baltimore, big-time song. You got Sean Strickland and Uriah Hall. You're not going to want to miss that. Let's keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks. And as we always say,
let's get into it.
We have one of the most interesting fights that you could make in the welterweight division this weekend. It is the return, I feel like I say this every time, of one Brian Barberani. He's going to be taking on Jason Witt. And I hate to joke about this, and I wish him nothing but the best, but he just had one of those Mike Tyson injuries back in 2019. His back was broken, spinal. But here's the trouble for Brian Barberina. That was in 2019. He comes back. He's one of the most exciting fighters you're going to find in the UFC. Beats Anthony Ivey. Looks great in that fight. And then, and I quote, Barberina himself is coming off a lengthy layoff after suffering from emergency exploratory laparotomy due to internal bleeding from a couple ruptured arteries in his omentum, via Barberina's Instagram. Matt, hate to see it. Absolutely hate to see it. Brian Barberina, major injuries, and hopefully, you know, just hoping for the best for Brian Barberina coming into a fight like this, because for Jason Witt, hasn't really looked the greatest in the UFC so far. So it feels like one of those, like, we're lobbing up a Brian Barberina win, but you're definitely afraid with all those injuries, right?
I mean, you're fucked if you think Jason Witt can beat Brian Barberina 100%. Like, Brian Barberina really has fought that next level of competition. He fought Vicente Luque and lost. But he beat the brakes off Sage Northcutt. Like, the point is that Brian Barberina has been in there and beaten good fighters. And yes, he comes up short against, like, the top level. But losing to guys like Randy Brown and Vicente Luque don't mean that much to me. His win over Jake Ellenberger was just a really, really nice TKO win where he did have some power shots.
Timeout. Whoa. He's 1-1 against the Ellenbergers. He beat Joe. No, I'm just kidding. He's 2-0 against the Ellenbergers. He beat both of them.
I don't know why you stopped me, but okay. So we beat Jake Ellenberger, and he looks great against Anthony Ivey. There's not a doubt in my mind that Brian Barberina at 100% can finish Jason Witt, because from Jason Witt, he just hasn't shown the ability to eat a power shot in the UFC. He hasn't. Like, against Cole Williams was never able to land on him, and he didn't even show up in shape. Cole Williams looked awful even, like, walking out to that fight. He obviously just barely even had a training camp. Cole Williams was not 100% going into that fight. That was a weird Cole Williams. Tekashi Sato lands one big shot, though, hurts Jason Witt. Jason Witt can't recover. Then he ends up getting knocked out. I thought going into the Semelsberger fight that Jason Witt had a really big opportunity to not become a top 15 fighter after that, but at least go, okay, I'm better than I was in that Sato loss. And he gets finished again. There's just nothing in Jason Witt's career that tells me he's going to be able to eat the shots of Brian Barberina if Brian Barberina does land on him. And I think Brian Barberina can easily defend a couple takedown attempts early on in a fight. Just Brian Barberina has been in there and done that with a lot of the really good fighters of this division. And I don't think Jason Witt's the type of guy who's going to be able to just out-wrestle Barberina consistently for 15 minutes.
Brian Barberina, I mean, this guy throws a ton of volume. He eats a lot of shots. I mean, 45% striking defense so far for Jason Witt. Lost to Sato. He beat Cole Williams. We were pretty hard on Cole Williams going into that fight against Jason Witt. Thought I had a pretty good read on it, because Witt, he's a really good wrestler. He's really good with his top pressure. I mean, you look at the way that he is. He's a short guy for the division. He's got a big upper body. And once he gets you down, he's so positionally aware that he can keep that top pressure, move around to the space that he needs. He can get the submission. He can throw the ground and pound. And then against Matt Semelsberger, I mean, we make jokes about it, like the Trevin Jones jokes and, well, the Trevin Giles jokes. These guys throw power jabs. But Matt Semelsberger threw one shot out there, and that was it. Like, it's obviously a detriment to your career when you look chinny. And I don't want to say that about Witt, but it hasn't looked all that great. Again, his striking defense in his three UFC fights, 29%. Like, that's not good. And you're getting finished in two of those fights. 50% on his takedown attempts. For Brian Barberina, 60% is his overall takedown defense. And if you look at it, let's pick some guys that took him down. Anthony Ivey got 5 takedowns in that fight, 230-27s and 129-28 for Barberina to get the win, because he threw more than triple the strikes in that one. You look at it, other than that, Leon Edwards was able to take him down. Colby Covington took him down 12 times. Sage Northcutt got 1. Joe Ellenberger got 3. Obviously, you're going to have numbers weighted, even from the Anthony Ivey fight as well as the Covington fight. But yeah, this it scares me a bit, because Brian Barberina, obviously the health issues coming from fall into the winter. Again, it seemed like it was November when those posts were out there. Barberina opened a -200. He's a -266. Jason Witt opened a +170. He's +211. If you go over to Tapology, the votes aren't even close. 985 total votes, 90% Barberina, 72% by knockout. For the 10% that have Witt, 53% by decision, 27% by knockout. I think Brian Barberina wins this fight too. I'm assuming he's probably going to win it by knockout as well. If Witt's able to work the takedown and keep him down, maybe you see a fight like that. So if you like Jason Witt, I'd even say by decision, if it's going to be a Jason Witt win, feels
it's
like I might be on,
it's
I might be on
an
Brian island.
Barberina by decision, just because of his volume. Like, even if you get the takedowns, it is hard because he's still going to get it back up to his feet. You got to remember, he dropped Leon Edwards when Leon Edwards was going for a takedown attempt. Like, he catches him with an uppercut and hurts him. This guy was big power against wrestlers who go for that. I just don't really see Witt having much of an avenue, to be honest.
Matt, both of us going with the returning Bam Bam Brian Barberina. And Matt, one Bam Bam just got a big fight today. You get Tai Tuivasa. He's going to be taking on Walt Harris. But listen, you're not going to want to miss the rest of this card. We got a big time main event. Oh boy, Uriah Hall's taking on Sean Strickland. Like I said, keep locked in with Fight Night Picks. And as we always say,
let's get into it.
Absolutely love this fight, and shouts to Max Friedman over on Twitter. He knew as soon as this one was announced to at me at Craig Allen FNP. But Matt, we have a couple of my guys. Kyung Ho Kong is going to be taking on Ronnie Yaya. And if you can't feel the excitement through the screen, I have no better way to share. Like, do you want my microphone? Do you want my shirt? Do you want my blood? I don't know what to tell you. I absolutely love this fight. Kyung Ho Kong, he's a guy that I've been excited about for a really long time. He's on a 3-fight win streak. Teruto Ishihara, you've got a big win against Liu Pingyuang's last time, and that one was by split. And before that, a split against Brandon Davis. But Kyung Ho Kong, he's like a Swiss Army knife. He's just kind of good everywhere. He can mix in his striking. He's a really tricky guy to try and figure out on the feet. And just when you think you've got him figured out, like Guido Canetti, well, he's just going to whip out one of the craziest takedowns you've ever seen. He's going to submit you. This guy is, and I say it again, a Swiss Army knife. And you look at it, I mean, big wins over fighters from Japan in the UFC. Shinichi Shimizu, Michinori Tanaka, and Teruto Ishihara. You look at it, his debut was back in 2013 against Alex Caceres. He fought Chico Camus. He fought Ricardo Ramos. That was back in 2018. Had a lengthy layoff from 2014 to 2018. Mandatory military service over in Korea. But man, I'm so glad we have my guy, Mr. Perfect, Kyung Ho Kong, back in the UFC. Because he's one of those guys that I feel like if he fought more often, he'd be like a more well-known fighter. I know that sounds stupid as I say it, but I wouldn't bridge on favorite. But listen, when I'm talking fan favorite, if you don't know my guy, Ronnie Yaya, by now, where have you been? Like, straight up, where have you been? This guy's coming into this fight at 36. He's almost 37. He's fought a litany of fighters. He has a fight against Chad Mendes. His UFC debut was at UFC Fight Night 23 against Mike Brown back in 2011. He has a win over Eddie Wineland with WEC. You remember how Eddie Wineland was the WEC Bantamweight champ? Ronnie Yaya beat him with WEC. He fought Kid Yamamoto and got knocked out by soccer kicks because that happened in K1. But other than that, really special fighter. First round rear naked choke win at WC 28 over one Mark Hominick, Canadian legend. I can go on and on about Ronnie Yaya. He's one of the more accredited jiu-jitsu players in MMA. Obviously, you have the Damian Mayas. You have the Rodolfo Vieiras. Ronnie Yaya cannot be denied. Matt, I think the craziest stat of all, this guy has 27 wins. 21 of them are by submission. All different types as well. North-south choke over John Hosman. You look at it in the UFC, he had a headbutt against Johnny Bedford. So what does he do? He comes out and Kimura's him the next time out. Such a special fighter. Also beat Michinori Tanaka in the UFC. And his last time out, he beat Ray Rodriguez earlier this year and submitted him. So my guy, Ronnie Yaya, still doing it. He kind of walks in like a what's that Pop Smoke song? Like a thief in the night? Like a thief on the night.
Like a thief in the night? Like a thief on the night. Like a thief in the night?
Creepy, creepy guy. But Matt, this guy's
the
a special
stiffest
player.
Thief you've ever seen. Like when he's I think of a thief stiff. In the knife, I think of someone, you know, with some fluidity to their movement. Ronnie's got none of that. Like the before and after pictures on most chiropractic commercials, Ronnie moves like the before, you know, and then they crack his back and then he moves like someone who could be considered a thief in the night, perhaps. But Ronnie is weird because every Ronnie Yaya fight is like, hey, I feel like the opposing corner just slaps the fighter in the face and they go, hey, don't let him get that head and arm position. And the fighter goes, great, I'm not going to let Ronnie Yaya get that head and arm position. And then at some point, I'm going to guess in the second, maybe even the third round, Ronnie Yaya finds himself in top position in like a head and arm choke, and he ends up winning. He's just crafty on the mat that way. And Ronnie Yaya isn't that kind of, he's like 70% of Ryan Hall, where he's not going to openly go for guard, like pull guard 12 times in a row, but he will pull guard. He is not afraid to do it in modern MMA, which is very much a lost art when you speak about things that used to be in MMA a lot that now you don't really see all that often. Ronnie is not afraid to pull guard. The other thing about Ronnie Yaya, though, that we have just sort of glanced over, his cardio is terrible nowadays. Like, he moves like a 37-year-old Brazilian man would. And hey, there's no shame against that, but he's had 38 fights in his career. You're gonna start accumulating damage at a certain point, and he is one of those fighters where it really comes down to, can Ronnie submit his opponent before the end of the second round, or is he gonna try to survive that third round? Because a lot of the time it does come down to him just trying to survive that last 5 minutes and not really fighting to win, but fighting not to lose. And I know that leaves a sour taste in a lot of people's mouths because it might not be the most fan-friendly style, but it's obviously hooked Craig Allen of Fight Night Picks, and that should really be all you need to know about Ronnie Yaya's fighting style. What I will say is that Yaya, at least as of late, has been in there with guys who have terrible submission defense, and it has made his skill set maybe look a little bit better than I think it truly is. Like, if you're going to beat Luke Saunders, how are you going to beat him? Well, you're probably going to heel hook him. If you're going to beat Russell Stone, how are you going to beat him? Well, you're probably going to submit him. Like, there's just Ray Rodriguez has like 15 losses and 13 of them are by submission. Like, Ronnie Yaya has been in there with some guys who are susceptible to the submission. I'm not saying he's not phenomenal on the mat, but I don't think Ronnie Yaya is the type of guy who can go out there and out-grapple a guy like Ryan Hall. I do put his grappling like maybe a tad bit underneath the top tier grapplers of this division, and this is the reason why. He doesn't really have the wrestling to go along with his jiu-jitsu. Ronnie Yaya is one of those guys where if he just had like a power double leg, he'd be that much more effective because a lot of his energy is spent trying to get his opponent to the mat. And then by the time he gets them down, he's only got like 30% of his energy to then try to go get a submission. For Hung Yeo Kong, if he could just keep this fight on the outside and again, use the space in between him and Ronnie as his takedown defense, I really do feel like he can just start accumulating, not record-breaking levels of volume, but he can definitely go out there and out-volume Ronnie Yaya on the feet for 15 minutes.
Kyung Ho Gong is taller, he's longer, he is younger, he also throws more in terms of volume.
And he's an insane athlete.
Yeah, he's a great athlete. The craziest stat, I want to throw this one at people, 3.3 is UFC average in terms of strikes. 3.3 is UFC average in terms of strikes landed per minute, but also received. So that's the average. It used to be 3.28 for the longest time. It's 3.3 right now. Ronnie Yaya lands 1.57 strikes per minute. He also receives 1.7, way below average. Kyung Ho Gong, 2.52 to 2.43 received. But normally he is very offensive with his takedown. So is Ronnie Yaya. The funny thing too, if you go to fightmetric.rds.ca and you look up this fight, 19% of the time Kyung Ho Gong is striking. 9% of the time Ronnie Yaya is striking. 19 and 9%. Those percentages are incredibly low in terms of the odds for this one. Kyung Ho Gong open minus 200. He's minus 140 right now as the favorite. Ronnie Yaya open a plus 170. He's a plus 114. And over on Tapology, 963 total votes, 67% Yaya, 74% by submission. For the 33% that have Kyung Ho Gong, 77% by decision. Matt, the odds have Kong, but Ronnie Yaya is gaining. The fans have my guy, Ronnie Yaya. So what are you saying for this one?
I feel like this is the fight Ronnie Yaya gets old. I really do. I think this is the fight where it's like, okay, that takedown attempt that maybe he could just kind of muster the athleticism to get, he isn't going to be able to get it. And I do feel like the youth and the athleticism of Chung Ho Gong and his ability to be either really close to Ronnie Yaya or really far on the outside, not spending a lot of that time on the in-between where Ronnie might be able to go in and go for his weird single leg takedown that he can transition into like a heel hook or that he can transition into a half guard sweep. I really do feel like this is Kong's fight to lose if he can keep it on the outside.
If Ronnie Yaya wins, the legend continues. But to me, it breaks my heart. I'm going to go against it. Kyung Ho Gong is, again, you talk about one of the more athletic fighters in this division. He's one of those guys that I wish you get to see more. And I know if you look at his early record, I mean, it wasn't the greatest. His last submission loss is his only submission loss. That was back in 2011 to Bae Young Kwon back at Road FC 2. Road FC's had a few more shows since then. He's got a win over Andrew Leone as well as a loss to Leone. That's a guy that's fought a lot of big names over in Asia. But again, Liu Pingyuang, Brandon Davis, Truto Ishihara, the wins in 2019. He lost to Hamosh by split in 2018. I think Hamosh is a totally different fighter since then, too, because he's added a ground component to his game. He's a fun guy to watch. But to me, yeah, I'm going with Kyung Ho Gong here. It breaks my heart. Both of us going with a fighter out of South Korea. I can't wait for this card, Matt. Main event, Hall taking on Strickland. You're not going to want to miss out. So keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks, as we always say.
Let's get into it.
I wish I was a little bit taller. I wish I was a baller. I wish I knew who was going to win our next fight. Matt, we have Cheyenne Bay. She's going to be taking on Gloria DePaula this weekend. And Matt, I don't know if people are going to like that reference. It's a little bit played out, but I'm going to run with it. Cheyenne Bay in her debut, losing to Montserrat Canejo. And we talked about it in extensive detail. The fact that you have to watch out for Montserrat's head and arm throws. What happened?
She did.
Just rinse and repeat. A lot of positional awareness by Montserrat Canejo and a lot of head and arm throws. Gets the win over Cheyenne Bays. The fight wasn't competitive at all. For Gloria DePaula, what do we say? Jinyu Fry, she's a crafty vet. We both had Gloria DePaula to win against Jinyu Fry because you assume that DePaula, she's such a great Muay Thai fighter. In her fight on Contender Series, she took on a really, really good fighter in terms of wrestling and grappling. And her takedown defense looked pretty good. And her ability to scramble back up to her feet looked really good. And against Jinyu Fry, she did not look very good. So Matt, now we're going into a fight where I had Bays to beat Canejo. I had DePaula to beat Fry. And now I'm here.
And you wish you never bought that stock to begin with. Because, like, here's the problem. This is the most, like, Jeff Hardy versus CM Punk loser of the steel cage goes home type of a match, you know? Like, I don't really think Gloria DePaula, if she loses to Cheyenne Bays, is like, wow, we really see a bright future for her in this division. And same thing for Cheyenne Bays. Like, you look that bad in your UFC debut that now we have to have this conversation. And I don't think this is going to be the co-main event by the time everything gets said and done for the weekend. I know Tapology currently has this listed, but I could not imagine the UFC somehow packaging this as the co-main event, because that's the thing. Cheyenne Bays is a good wrestler. She does have decent offensive takedowns. She should be a decent defensive grappler when you think about it, but didn't demonstrate any of those things in her UFC debut. And this is the big problem I have. We talk a lot about people's training and the things they do in training. And then once they get to the UFC, they don't demonstrate any of those abilities that we originally thought that they once had. Cheyenne Bays, I think she still is a good grappler, but I think the fact that she was beat to the punch, and by that term, I mean she was the one getting taken down, not the one getting the offensive takedowns, meant that her grappling off her back showed kind of the worst version of her skill set the first time out. Now, for Gloria DePaula, I'll be honest, the takedown attempts that Jinyu Fry was going on her weren't all that advanced. This wasn't like Daniel Cormier against Derek Lewis at Madison Square Garden, where it's like high crotch to an ankle pick, like just kind of having a field day with him. Jinyu Fry is just getting like strength takedowns on Gloria DePaula. She's able to accomplish most of them.
And in that fight, I mean, Jinyu Fry, it only took her 2 takedown attempts. I mean, in terms of the strikes, total strikes, 51 for DePaula to 50 of Jinyu Fry. And in terms of significant strikes, DePaula actually had 31 to Fry's 24. But it was 9 minutes and 33 seconds of control time for Fry. It was a win for Jinyu Fry, 29-28. It was unanimous. I almost said it was split, but it was unanimous for her. And to me, we didn't really learn much out of Gloria DePaula. Okay, is she a good striker? Well, yeah, we knew that going into it. How good's her takedown defense? Well, Jinyu Frey took her down for a long time. Former Adam Waite made the move up. That was her UFC, our first win in the UFC for Jinyu Frey, who's also competing on this card, who's a teammate of Cheyenne Bays. Now, we talk about it. You look at it for DePaula. I mean, she's got a pretty damn good training partner at home as well, Maeda Buena Silva, and they also train together at Shoot the Box Diego Lima. So you like to see that, but it's really tough for me. So again, I open this one up because I'm really up in the air on this one. I'm having a hard time trying to figure out the pick. So I do want to get the insight from you here.
People are going to like this, but in a low level fight, you almost have to go for who's the better wrestler. It's just what it comes down to, because wrestling is the easiest way to get control time, and time is the easiest thing to get control, to get points on the judges' scorecard, because neither one of these fighters is going to blow the doors off the other than the striking. Like, Gloria DePaula is the better striker, but the fact that Cheyenne Bays is going to be spamming takedown attempts for the majority of this fight is good to negate a lot of the space that Gloria DePaula really needs to let her striking go. So for Bays, I think if she does just spam takedown attempts, keep this up against the cage, get the occasional takedown here or there, I think she'll be able to hold DePaula down if she is able to get those takedowns, and just kind of rinse and repeat from there. I don't think this is going to be a fun fight to watch, if that's what you're asking me.
So, listen, we got to give credit where credit's due. MMAprospects.com, friend of the show on the Twitter sphere. It's Sean Bitter. These are the grades that they had for Cheyenne Bays coming into the UFC. The name of the article is Octagon Oracle's Contender Series Standout Cheyenne Bays. Sean gave her a grade of an A minus, and he put, Bays has solid wrestling and it's slightly overrated. She has a good top position, and her ground and pound is fight changing. We've seen that before. He thinks she's a top 10 talent. Vince Rotimer, B plus. She has shown striking and wrestling, and she's extremely aggressive, maybe a top 15 fighter. Tom Albano, Bays displays some decent wrestling and grappling skills, being able to hold her own on the ground, possible top 15. And then the last one, very good friend of the show and somebody that I used to co-host the show with, and Kristen King, she said she is a very good wrestler and maintains much of the top control over her opponents when the fight goes to the ground. I like that out of Cheyenne Bays as well. Like you said, Bays opened a minus 150 favorite. She's a minus 175 right now. DePaula opened a plus 130. She's a plus 145. And if we have a look at the Tapology votes, not even close. 969 total votes, 78% Bays, 89% by decision. For the 22% that have DePaula, 82% by decision. I'm going with Bays. Again, it's not based on the fact that she's a world beater at this point, and she totally got out-wrestled, so it might seem weird that we're going with a wrestling point. For Gloria DePaula, she looked great in that Contender Series fight against a proven and almost potent, like to the point where that's the only style that they have, but a great wrestler. But for DePaula, I have a tricky time going with her. If she can get it into the clinch, if she can land her Muay Thai knee, she is such a great Thai fighter that maybe there's an opportunity for her to get a big win. But Cheyenne Bays is pretty well known as a striker too. We haven't even really talked about that all that much. So
let's not die on that hill though. Let's not, Cheyenne Bays' striking is not what you want to bring up. It's very like Ronda Rousey. I'm just going to rush in aggressively with hooks. I wouldn't really mention that as like a selling point on the house. That's not like an in-ground pool. It's not something you know, like, I think Cheyenne Bays has a borderline top 15 future. I really think she's going to struggle with the other prospects of this division. Like, go back even not that long ago when Mackenzie Dern was on her way up. The thing that she could always rely on was, okay, no matter what, if she gets people down, it's pretty much over, right? Like, no matter what happens in the fight, if it goes to the mat, she's going to have a chance. With Cheyenne Bays, it's not like at every point on the feet, she could knock out her opponent. It's not like on the mat, she's this massive submission threat. Like, she really is going to have to use cage control and her takedowns in effective manners. And again, it's not the most aesthetically pleasing way to win, but I think it's going to be able to get it done against Gloria DePaula.
Both of us going with Cheyenne Bays in this fight. If you can make a good argument, you let us know down below in the comment section. If you like Gloria DePaula in this fight, we want to hear from you because we have question mark kicks on Saturday. And it's great to talk about some of those comments over there. Can't wait for this fight card. We have Uriah Hall and Sean Strickland in the main event. You're not going to want to miss that. So keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks. As we always say,
let's get into it.
Oh, hello. You caught me at a bad time. I'm actually traveling this week. And like I said, when I travel, boom, Manscaped. It comes along with me. I've got the Shed travel bag right there, and it works so good. Let me move some things around. Look at that. We get the weed whacker, the nose hair trimmer. It works great on the go. And I've said that before. I mean, I've got nose hair. It's not like when I travel, the nose hair gets any better. You got to make sure that you actually use it a little bit more. Look at that. It's the weed whacker. Now, boom. But when I traveled, the best thing about it, 1, 2, 3. You see that? 1, 2, 3. Oh, and now it's all the way down. You got to make sure you use that travel lock when you're traveling. And what else do I have with me? I've got some great products in the shed, as I always do. I got the Crop Preserver Ball Deodorant. And you know how well that stuff works. You want to be fresh when you're on the go. You can also use their great product. It's called the Crop Reviver Ball Toner. And I know Matt Allen, he's got these great products with him at home. And you should too. And if you order the Performance Package from Manscaped, you're going to get the Shed Travel Bag. I was able to snag one of their shirts. Like it says, your balls will thank you. And I mean, there's great products there. They also have the great boxer briefs. They're going to fit great. You're going to enjoy them. Make sure you check them out. It's manscaped.com. Use the promo code FNP to let them know that we sent you over there. And like I said, when I'm traveling, I've always got my Manscaped. And it's no word of a lie. I haven't been home for the last couple of weeks, and I'm absolutely enjoying the product. So, like I said, Manscaped.com, use promo code FNP. You're going to get 20% off and free shipping. And as we always say, let's get into it.
If you're a fan of smooth jazz and Red Bull, this is going to be a fight that fires you up. We have primetime Uriah Hall. He's going to be taking on Sean Strickland. Matt, why do I say that? It's because Sean Strickland lives life in the fast lane. And I'm not making light or making a joke about the accident that he had that forced him away from the cage for a very long time. But you look at the way that Sean Strickland fights, and it's like Brett Laurie playing for the BJs back in 2013. This guy is all speed, and he's got zero breaks, and he is absolutely going for it. For Sean Strickland, it's the pace, it's the pressure, it's the striking. We saw it in the rematch against John Phillips, and I know that, or sorry, Jack Marshman, and I know that's a name that, listen, do I get my Welsh fighters in some of the higher weight classes mixed up sometimes? But in that fight, he's yelling at Marshman to kind of engage with him in the third round. He's having a lot of fun. He knocks out Brennan Allen, and then he goes into a fight against Christoph Jocko, and it's just pressure, 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 pressure. And what did you say getting ready for that fight? Well, the boxing of Sean Strickland and the pace is really hard to figure out, but Christoph Jocko is a pretty good kickboxer, and he's good off his back foot. Maybe Jocko has a great chance. He did not, and Sean Strickland continued to dominate. And Sean Strickland's one of those fighters that I don't know what you expected out of him at 170 pounds, but his only losses have aged like the finest of wines. Santiago Ponzinibbio, Kamaru Usman, and Eliseu Zaleski dos Santos. Ooh. And Eliseu was on a run at that point. So obviously the weight cut was a huge difference maker. He beats Nurdin Taleb in Moncton, New Brunswick, Canada. And then, of course, he has that terrible motorcycle accident, and he's totally got to redo everything. And now he's out of Syndicate MMA training with some great fighters. But he's going to be taking on, I say, smooth jazz, because Uriah Hall just goes out there, and it is so much fun to watch this guy perform. Obviously, his last two fights, he's looked amazing. He beats Anderson Silva and Chris Weidman, legends. But before that, on this four-fight win streak, he beats Antonio Carlos Jr. He knocks out Bavon Lewis at the end of the fight. That was just such a classic throwback win for Uriah Hall, one of the best counter strikers in the game. You know, I absolutely love this fight, so I really want to get your thoughts on it.
This fight's going to be phenomenal. I really do think it will be, because Uriah Hall kind of thrives on being the guy getting backed up. We've seen it in his fights before. Now, he has varying levels of success when he is getting backed up, but at least as of late, he's developed into a really good, like, I'm going to plant and throw once I decide to. Because if you look at the Bavon Lewis fight, like, Lewis is moving forward, putting combinations together. And trust me, no one's been more critical of the UFC career, Bavon Lewis, than your boy over here. But Uriah Hall flatlined him the second he decided to pull the trigger. And you could kind of tell, like, he's just not doing anything, not doing anything, not doing anything. And the second he decides to go, he flatlines him in one shot. The Antonio Carlos Jr. fight was not a split decision. He easily won two of those three rounds, and he was doing real damage to Carlos Jr. on the feet too. There's this beautiful knockdown where he basically like steps through Carlos Jr. and hits him with a straight shot, puts him down, hurts him bad. I thought Uriah Hall easily won that fight. This Anderson Silva fight was weird, and I'm going to get into that fight a little bit more here in a second. But this fight, oddly enough, reminds me of Aljamain Sterling versus Piotr Jan. And I know that's weird, but hear me out. Sean Strickland is kind of like Aljamain Sterling, not in their grappling, but in their stand-up, where I throw a lot. There's not a lot of just times in my fight where I'm paused and I'm just stationary, not doing anything. I'm either getting reads on my opponent, I'm throwing feints, or I'm throwing in volume, trying to land a combination. Very similar to Aljamain Sterling. Piotr Jan, and the reason I like Piotr Jan in that first fight against Aljo, was that Piotr Jan is a very intelligent fighter who, the more you throw at him oddly enough, kind of helps him, you know? Like, the more reads you're giving him and the more I'm throwing at you, okay, you're giving him more information to work with as the fight goes on. And the more reads you're giving him early on is going to help him more and more and more. Uriah Hall's very similar to where he won't always have to be offensive for him to sort of be winning the fight. The more data you give him and the more data that he can download in the fight is actually going to help him speed up the process. Kind of like in the Anderson Silva fight. Anderson Silva, he's throwing a lot of feints. And even though he is old, he's still a very crafty striker and a very veteran savvy one at that. So against Uriah Hall, it took a little bit of time for Uriah Hall to really find the opening and hurt Silva in their fight. But then you can go back and even look at like the Christophe Jaco fight to parallel that one with the one that Strickland had. Jaco has Hall kind of hurt almost up against the cage in the first round. But the more Jaco throws at him helps Uriah Hall get those reads off him. And then he eventually flatlines him with an overhand. When Uriah Hall decides to pull the trigger, there are few fighters in the UFC more dangerous than he is. And I feel comfortable saying that across multiple weight classes. Like, in the how scared would I be if I was locked in the cage with this person? Uriah Hall's at, like, the top of the list. Because you know at any moment he can put you on, like, the MMA equivalent of Dwayne Wade over Anderson Vera Zhao type of a poster. You know, like, he has that type of a highlight reel ability. And with Sean Strickland, it really does come down to, can the volume of Sean Strickland eventually break the rhythm and the timing of Uriah Hall? Because with Uriah Hall, everything comes down to confidence. If you can break his confidence in a fight like Paulo Costa did, Paulo Costa ate Uriah Hall's best shots and just kept on walking forward. There's a reason that I like Paulo Costa and his volume so much now is because I saw him eat Uriah Hall's power shots, still able to walk through those and meet him with more power. He was able to kind of break the spirit almost of Uriah Hall, where it's like, okay, you ate my best shots, you're still coming forward. What else are you going to do? Against Sean Strickland, I think it's going to be a lot of the same forward pressure from Sean Strickland. I just don't think Strickland has that crippling power that Costa has, to where when Costa's landing, every shot I land on you is going to accumulate. With Strickland, there is a lot of pitter-patter followed by the power shots at the end of his combinations, and I worry that Sean Strickland's going to really have to take a lot of time for those power shots to accumulate, and by the time that those power shots do start to accumulate, that's when Uriah Hall's going to get his reads on Sean Strickland. I know that was a really long-winded explanation, but I hope that that was a decent way of breaking this fight down.
Should Sean Strickland open up with two back-to-back leg kicks to start it off?
No, because this is the problem. If you kick with a guy like Uriah Hall, you're helping him stay at his own range. Like, that's the weird thing about Uriah Hall. He's going to be so far away from Sean Strickland to begin with that Strickland really is going to have to throw his first three punches in this combination to try to land number four and number five, because Uriah Hall will be moving backwards a lot. And we've seen Hall struggle with power punchers. We don't really see him struggle with volume punchers. And I really do put Strickland in. Listen, he has great power, but a lot of the times, even the Brendan Allen fight, he's not going out there hitting him with one shot. It's 5, 6, 7 clean shots. And then those 7 clean shots turn into 12, which turn into 15, which turn into 20. It's just when you're throwing with that crazy amount of volume, you're leaving windows and you're leaving holes for a guy like Uriah Hall to capitalize on. And I do think Uriah Hall has enough power to put down Strickland at 185 pounds.
Significant strikes absorbed per minute for both of these guys. 3.54 for Hall, 3.64 for Strickland. Matt, landed per minute, 5.14 for Strickland, 3.34 for Hall. All of their numbers are above the UFC averages. Oh. And in terms of defense, a little bit better for Sean Strickland, 67% to 53% for Hall. But the accuracy, 51% for Hall, 39% for Sean Strickland. Listen, Strickland normally goes for a takedown a little bit more than Uriah Hall, but both guys below average. They're both strikers. And for Uriah Hall, Matt, what would you say his best counter-striking performance was? Was it the Pavon Lewis or was it the fight against Gegard Mousasi that he won?
I mean, the Gegard Mousasi one is one of the greatest like highlights of all time, a jumping, spinning back kick into a flying knee. If you're just going off a counter-striking performance, though, you could bring up the Anderson Silva fight just because against Silva and against a guy who is so high level in that aspect, it was really nice. But I always like to think of it was the Christophe Jaco fight, because he does get hurt early on in that fight, and then he is able to get over that adversity and hurt Jaco. And for the longest time, that was kind of the story about Uriah Hall. It's make him face adversity and he won't get through the other side of it. At least the Jaco fight was the first fight where he started to show, okay, I can absorb some damage and then still get through it.
So when you look at this fight, again, Strickland's been on this run. We've seen kind of what he does. He just walks guys down. He almost stands a little bit square. He walks you down. He outboxes you. He might taunt you. you know exactly what's going to happen, but these guys haven't been able to figure it out. And I think even that Brennan Allen win, now it's recency bias because it was last weekend, but it ages really well because Brennan Allen was able to outstrike Punahele Soriano. Whoever thought that was
going to happen. Different Brennan Allen.
Well, but it wasn't even that long ago. That's a crazy thing. So when I look at this one for Strickland, since he's come back, two wins in 2020, a win over Krzysztof Szatko back in May, and he's coming into this one a pretty decent favorite. He opened a minus 180. He's a minus 217 right now for Uriah Hall. Opened a plus 155. He's a plus 175 right now. Tapology votes. Surprise to us there to you. 1,051 total votes, 59% Strickland, 55% of the voters having to win by decision, 39% having to win by knockout. For the 41% that have Hall, 21% by decision, 71% by knockout. And if you look at it for Sean Strickland, he spent some of this camp, not just at Syndicate, but at Extreme Couture with Eric Nixick, as well as 10th Planet, BJJ. Casey Halstead's getting all the top fighters training at 10th Planet now, just before they get to go to the dance. So credit where credit's due. I try and pump his tires every time I can, so here's the opportunity. But when I look at this fight, Sean Strickland, again, pure boxer, a little bit in terms of height, a little bit less in terms of reach. I have a hard time. It's going to be Uriah Hall's birthday, too. He turns 37 on fight day, so kudos to him. What's the final pick here?
I think the counter-striking of Uriah Hall will win out eventually. And I understand it might look ugly until it doesn't. And there might be some mean people online throughout the first two rounds saying, hey, Uriah Hall looks like shit right now. But in classic Uriah Hall fashion, he is kind of like that middleweight version of Derek Lewis. I understand what Uriah Hall does is a lot flashier, but it is very much that it's going to look bad until it doesn't. But when he does land that counter shot, it is devastating. And Sean Strickland, there's not a lot of give to him. He's not a guy who can eat a shot and really rolls with it well. And I do feel like if Uriah Hall can catch him with that one big counter, he's going to put him down. The guys who Strickland's been in there with as of late, none of them have been even near the level of striking of Uriah Hall. Whereas Uriah Hall has fought many guys who can strike as well as Sean Strickland, if not better. Like, Sean Strickland's a good striker, but even you wouldn't tell me Sean Strickland's a better striker than Paulo Costa. He's not better than Derek Brunson, I don't think, or at least he doesn't have the power of Derek Brunson. That's fair
to say.
What about
Oluwole Bamboje?
Oluwole Bamboje got flatlined by Uriah Hall with some brutal ground and pound. So, hey, it happens. But Uriah Hall's been in there with the Thiago Santoses of the world. Like, he knows how to be in there with other high-level strikers. And when Uriah Hall loses, it's because it's a guy who has more power than him who can catch him, or it's a guy who has really good wrestling. Sean Strickland doesn't really possess either one of those things. I think this will be a very good fight. And honestly, I think this is going to be fight of the night. But my final pick is Uriah Hall.
I'm oddly in agreement. I like the underdog in this fight. Wow. Again, I think in terms of the reads, if you back Uriah Hall up, it's going to be really tough for Sean Strickland to get the win that way. I mean, listen, we've seen him go a hard three rounds and just continue to go. Again, that Jack Marshman fight, I didn't think Sean Strickland was going to have that kind of cardio coming back off the injury that he had.
Marshman, though.
The guy's missing the majority of one knee. And he comes back in there and he looks amazing. So, I mean, I love the cardio from Sean Strickland, but the staying power of Uriah Hall. We've seen him in five-round fights. He had the five-rounder against Anderson Silva. Say what you will, he beat Julio Cesar Chavez Jr. I mean, he's going to be fighting one of the Paul brothers in boxing. It's Logan. It's not Jake. And it's like getting a striped bass. I mean, it's cool. It's cool. It's not a pike, but it's cool. But overall, yeah, I like Uriah Hall in this fight as well. We're both going with the underdog out of Jamaica in Uriah Hall to get the win. Fortis MMA's own Matt. We got a great card coming up this weekend. It's interesting. Fights have dropped out. Fights have been added. We're away from home. So make sure you keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks as we continue to update this card. But overall, big time middleweight contest here. You let us know who you've got down below in the comments section. Keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks. And as we always say,
let's get into it.